It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
Fight me.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 642 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off. Here it is, Elimination Chamber Sunday, March 8th, 2020. I am the Solid Monster, the Big Show's new Netflix series. Talked about that last week. I think it was last week when I was talking about the Broken Skull Sessions. Didn't have an air date. Didn't have a debut date for the show. Now we know that the Big Show show will drop on Netflix the day after WrestleMania, April 6th. So expect to start seeing him making the media rounds soon to promote it. I always said Big Show should be in a comedy, in a sitcom, on the WWE Network. So instead it'll be on a different service. Audible is providing listeners of this show with a great offer, as they've been doing for a while now. You can get one free audiobook of your choosing when you sign up for a 30-day trial of the service at our link, audibletrial.com/solidmonster. You can listen on the go across multiple devices, not lose your place. Thousands of titles to choose from, a lot of wrestling books. So use our link, sign up, and get yourself a free book, audibletrial.com/solidmonster. And if you want to become a PayPal VIP, you may do so at any time. Just go to thesolidmonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out. I want to say thank you this week to all of our fine VIPs who showed their support, for which I am very grateful. To Interfere and I'll Kill You, Inga Wabu, still one of my favorite nicknames. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Deadpool, James Herrera. The Florida Freebird, Brian Becerra. Out of Control, Cody Thomas. Beast Mode, Brock Joseph. Billy Hardcore, Habibi. Another longtime listener there. Killshot, Keith Hart. Steven Handyman, Halistic. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. Josh, The Shooter, Stockton. Diamond Dallas, Dance Machine. Harrison Soep, New York Punk. Arnold Modesto. No Nickname Required, Joshua Garrett. Russell the Muscle. First Class, Cameron Johnson, a first-time donator to the show. And Nitrous Oxide, Nathan Kania. Thank you for the note, Nathan. I appreciate it. I do see all the notes that people send me if you put a note in the notes field. I can't reply back to it, but I do see the notes that you include. It's kind of weird. Some people say there is no notes section, and they have to email me separately, which is fine. And then some people have a notes section. They include a note. I don't know why some can and some can't. I guess you have the haves and the have-nots. Anyway, thank you for that. Ted Hallowell has a podcast called No Hugging, No Learning, which is a show about a man, that being himself, watching Seinfeld for the first time in his life alongside his co-host, who has seen every episode of the show, which should be required viewing for everyone. When he told me about this, I thought this was a very clever, interesting concept for a podcast. They talk about what jokes from the show still work today. What worked back then that would never fly today. Things that are so cringe they never should have even made air in the first place. So they're dropping a brand new episode today covering the Hamptons episode from season 5. That's the episode where George experiences shrinkage after emerging from the pool. I quote this show more than any other TV show or movie that I've ever seen, as do a lot of my friends. So download the episode now. Plus all the previous ones, go to nohugging.com, or you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio. They're also on Twitter, at nohugging. And you know, I was thinking about this, actually recently, even before Ted told me about his show, I was thinking about this as I was watching this latest season of Curb Your Enthusiasm. You know, Seinfeld lasted 9 seasons. Okay, Curb is already up to its 10th season, although Seinfeld had a lot more episodes. Like, I think almost 100 more so far than Curb. HBO has those 10-episode per season type stuff. The sitcoms back then, probably the same way today. I mean, you're talking seasons that probably had 20 episodes. So there's a lot more Seinfeld than there is Curb. But the humor is very similar because of Larry David, right? And I love Curb. You don't have the same restrictions on cable, on HBO, that you do on network television. So it's more of an adult show. But if you're a fan of both, what do you think is the better overall show? I was thinking about this recently. You know, is the better show Seinfeld or Curb Your Enthusiasm? It's a tough one. I'd say Seinfeld is more of an ensemble where the characters other than Jerry have their own stories during a lot of the episodes, whereas, you know, Curb, it really is the Larry David show. And it's about how he interacts with people and how weird he is in different social situations. I love Curb to death, but if this were a buy or sell question, I'm going to cut you off because I know somebody's going to email it to me. Ooh, buy or sell, Solid Monster. If this were a buy or sell question, I still think I'm buying on Seinfeld. I would think though that if you're not a Seinfeld fan, you probably wouldn't like Curb, just because a lot of the humor is the same. But I'm sure these people exist. I'm sure there are people out there who watch that, but not, you know, watch one but not the other. You know, but people that didn't like Seinfeld but like Curb. But yeah, if I had to buy on one, I still think I'm buying on Seinfeld. It just, I can't bet against that. Anyway, there's more shouts coming in a few minutes. I had to break them up. We had a lot this week, so if you didn't hear your name or your shout-out, don't worry. I'm going to get back to some of the final ones here in just a few minutes. Scott Steiner, I want to just mention this up front. Scott Steiner collapsed backstage at the Impact tapings in Atlanta on Friday night. He had to be rushed to the hospital. He was there to be part of a throwback TNA-themed episode that was being filmed. He said... or, you know, of the people who were there, they said that he was fine all day long. I don't know if he wrestled a match or how many matches or if he just made an appearance. I'm not sure how physically involved he was up until that point in the night. But they said he just collapsed and he was being worked on by paramedics on the scene. He was transported to the ER. You know, very scary situation. Now, he's okay now. Scott D'Amore tweeted, said Steiner's okay. Tommy Dreamer also tweeted from the hospital, said he was doing well. And I saw that Steiner's wife, Krista, tweeted last night that he will make a 100% full recovery, which is good news. Hopefully that's the case. But when Sean Ross Sapp first tweeted that Steiner had collapsed backstage and was rushed to the hospital, I feared the worst. So I'm thankful I don't have to come on here today and record an in memoriam segment on the man's career. Because it sounded very dicey there for a while. I'm sure if, you know, people were there, probably were scared out of their wits. And, yeah, look, I mean, look at the history of a lot of these wrestlers. So I think your mind automatically goes to, you know, negative thoughts and you fear the worst. And thankfully, it looks like he's doing better. So hopefully that continues. After SmackDown on Friday night, I recorded my Elimination Chamber preview and predictions for the pay-per-view tonight, which included some scattered thoughts on Raw and SmackDown from this past week. Also, my thoughts on the report that Vince McMahon may already be possibly souring on Shayna Baszler, and a sad tweet involving, and I can't believe I'm even saying this, but a sad tweet involving The Undertaker. Just sounds so wrong. Runs a little over 30 minutes. We get into a lot of good stuff here. Again, it's about 30 minutes long. And on the flip side, we will get into the rest of the news of the week. So here is my Elimination Chamber rundown and predictions. WWE Elimination Chamber is live this Sunday from Philadelphia, the final stop before WrestleMania. Let's run down the card and give predictions. I'll mix in some Raw and SmackDown thoughts from this week's shows as we go along here. With plans obviously changing and Goldberg beating The Fiend to win the Universal title, they have eliminated the planned men's SmackDown Chamber match that Roman Reigns almost certainly would have won unless they wanted to swerve everybody and then have him win the shot back a couple of weeks ago. They wouldn't have done that. It would have been a Roman Reigns win. It was very predictable, so I don't mind them cutting. It's almost like cutting out the middleman. Even though it is kind of goofy that he just sort of walked into the ring and requested a title match when everybody else has to earn it, you could argue that Roman never technically lost the championship. He had to give it up. I think you're reaching. I mean, that was so long ago. But again, I'm not complaining. The outcome was never in doubt. But they obviously changed plans. You had people like Sheamus on television talking about entering the chamber match, and now there is none. And the SmackDown Women's Chamber match that Lacey Evans had alluded to, I mean, they never outright came out and announced a SmackDown Women's Chamber match, but she did that sit-down with Renee Young a couple of weeks ago, and she was talking about entering the chamber, talking about like there was going to be a third chamber match on this pay-per-view, and that has not been mentioned at all since then, including on the Go Home show this week. So she obviously misspoke, or probably more likely, they just changed their minds. They changed their minds on that too, and they eliminated it. Who knew that Elimination Chamber was to be taken so literally? They eliminated two different chamber matches from this show. I cannot remember the last time that we had an Elimination Chamber pay-per-view. There was a time where the Elimination Chamber was a pretty big deal. As far as stipulation shows are concerned, Money in the Bank now is kind of, I think, the de facto big gimmick show of all the gimmick shows now. Chamber and this, or Chamber and Money in the Bank, Hell in a Cell, TLC. I would say Money in the Bank is clearly sort of the main one of the bunch. I'm not a big fan of the gimmick shows to begin with. I would just stick with Money in the Bank and get rid of all the other ones if it were up to me. But I don't recall a time where we had a Chamber pay-per-view, which used to be kind of a big deal, that just felt so insignificant. It just does not it feels like a complete afterthought, this pay-per-view does. And I can't remember the last time, and this is part of the reason why, that we had an Elimination Chamber pay-per-view where neither of the chamber matches on the show were being contested either for a shot at one of the top titles in the company or for the actual titles themselves. No Universal Championship match, no WWE Championship match, and no match for either title to find out who goes to WrestleMania. In this case, it would have been for the Universal Championship, since Drew won the Royal Rumble. Nothing. And I can't remember the last time that happened. So many of the top names are not even on the show. Brock Lesnar and Drew McIntyre, they're not on the show either. I thought their segment from Raw Monday night was great. One of the highlights of the show, Lesnar ate not one, but three Claymore kicks. He sold the crap out of them. Even a small little detail like Lesnar telling McIntyre to grab the belt. Everybody was analyzing the audio when the show was over. It was like the Zapruder video of the JFK assassination. I think I hear Brock Lesnar saying something to Drew McIntyre. Oh, he's telling him to get the belt. Little things like that. That Lesnar is helpful with. Every now and then. Lesnar knows what to do and when. He's a veteran guy. I know he's not there all the time, but he's been doing this a long time. Don't forget, Brock Lesnar's been training since 2000, probably. I'm maybe 99. I'm guessing 2000 is when he goes back with WWE. So he's not exactly a rookie at this. And he tells Drew to go grab the belt, and Drew scurries over and grabs it and poses with it. Hopefully that's not an omen for him. Lesnar did what he needed to do to make Drew feel like a real threat. And I'm sure there's an F5 in his future, maybe three of them, just like he took three Claymore kicks. I thought the first, just to wrap up with Raw here, I thought the first two and the last two segments from Raw Monday night were quality. Everything in the middle almost put me to sleep. I have nothing good to say about much that happened in the middle of that show. It's like, who needs anesthesia? Who needs anesthesia or a chloroform rag when you've got the middle 2 hours of Raw to knock you out each week? The cure for insomnia. For me, the cure for insomnia is the Home Shopping Network. If I ever can't fall asleep, I just put Home Shopping Network on. Get a couple of women on there showing bracelets on their wrists. Out like a light. 30 seconds later, I'm out. Who needs it? Who needs it? Just watch the middle of Monday Night Raw. So let's run down this card here. Just added to the pay-per-view, Drew Gulak is getting a match one-on-one with Daniel Bryan. This started when Gulak told Bryan a couple of weeks ago that he had put together a PowerPoint presentation about Bryan's weaknesses. He was trying to help him get back to his winning ways. He was going to show him what he's been doing wrong. And on SmackDown this week, Bryan challenged Gulak to fight him at the Elimination Chamber if he's so confident that he can exploit Bryan's weaknesses. I'm going to go with Gulak here. I am picking Drew Gulak to win this match. I think Gulak will shock Daniel Bryan. It'll be a fluke win. He'll find some kind of weakness to exploit. He'll shock Bryan, and then they'll meet again. I wouldn't be surprised to find out that Bryan requested this, that he requested to work a program with Drew Gulak. Maybe they could even take this all the way to WrestleMania. I mean, think about it. When you think of who's available, all the key matches for WrestleMania have been set. We know what all the key matches are going to be. And I'm sure Edge and Orton, that'll be made official on Monday night. Where does Daniel Bryan fit into all this? It would be an injustice to just shove him in the Battle Royal. Hey, you know what? A program with Drew Gulak, the matches those two could probably have. Why not? So I'm picking Gulak for a shock win here. We've got our first of two Elimination Chamber matches for the SmackDown Tag Team titles. The champions, John Morrison and The Miz, defend against The Usos, The New Day, Heavy Machinery, Lucha House Party, and Dolph Ziggler and Bobby Roode. Ziggler and Roode will enter the chamber last per their win on SmackDown in the Gauntlet match. Boy, they sure do love their Gauntlet matches. And I will say that more often than not, WWE, if there's one formula that they have that does tend to work, not all the time, it is their Gauntlet match formula. There have been some damn good Gauntlet matches that they've had, going back to the one that Seth Rollins had on Raw where he lasted an hour. That was a couple of years ago. Or maybe it was early last year. It might have been a year ago. It's so hard to keep track of time. Everything these days just sort of blends together. But that was one example last year. Actually, that was probably 2 years ago. Last year was the Kofi Kingston Gauntlet. I remember that being very good. They went a little Gauntlet crazy there for a while last year, and then they cooled it a little bit. It's almost as though they just rely on it as a crutch. It's an easy way for them to kill almost an hour of the show. This Gauntlet went over 40 minutes. They killed almost the entire second hour of SmackDown this week with this Gauntlet match. But I can't complain. Heavy Machinery was the story here. Heavy Machinery started the Gauntlet. They nearly went the distance. They went all the way to the bitter end before they finally lost. Otis is big time over right now. You listen to the reactions that he's getting, and not to take anything away from Tucker, because Tucker was over too, but not as much as Otis. So whatever they're doing with Otis is working. It's why I've loved this story so much on this show. It's a simple story with him and Mandy and Dolph, but it's working. It's getting him over even more. Dolph Ziggler is hated. He is one of the most hated men in this entire company. You know, before I felt nothing. I felt nothing when this man would walk out. I felt dead on the inside, as he probably has for the last few years of his career. I felt apathy for Dolph Ziggler. Now at least I feel hatred. At least I feel something. When this man walks out, I feel hate. That's the emotion that I feel. This story is working. It's building to something at WrestleMania. I don't know if it's a tag team match, a mixed tag, a singles match. You know, one of the rumors was a singles match with Otis and Dolph, with Mandy as the referee. There's a few different ways that you can go with this. Me personally, I'm hoping that we get the reveal before WrestleMania that it was probably Sonya who texted Otis and tried to sabotage their Valentine's Day date, and we end up with some kind of a mixed tag. But really, the issue is Otis and Dolph. Somebody is playing them against each other, but the issue is Otis and Dolph. And the people couldn't wait for Otis to get his hands on Dolph. He got a couple of shots in on SmackDown, but he has not yet gotten his revenge. And in the end, it was Ziggler with a super kick to put down Otis, so he and Roode will enter last. They will not win. As far as the prediction here, look, one other quick thing from the Gauntlet. I hate that Miz and Morrison, I know it played into the story that, you know, Heavy Machinery had to go to the very end, so they kind of had to do something here, but I hate that Miz and Morrison have now lost back-to-back matches coming out of sweet Saudi money and winning the tag team championships. They have been losers on television. As far as my pick, Miz and Morrison just won the belts. It's too soon to hand them back to the Usos. It's too soon to hand them back to New Day. What is to be gained by doing that? So what is that? Reign number 8 for the New Day if they win the belts back? Nobody wants to see that. You know, Lucha House Party isn't winning. And I think Otis and Dolph in the Chamber, you know, those two teams are basically going to cancel each other out. That leaves Miz and Morrison. Miz and Morrison to retain. We have new Raw Tag Team Champions. They are the Street Profits. They defend against the former champions, Murphy, and the Monday Night Messiah. Now, on Raw Monday Night, they called it a now or never match for the tag team titles. I thought they had a fun little match. AOP tried to interfere. They got tossed. Referee was distracted. Kevin Owens ran up from behind Rollins. He gave him a stunner. Montez Ford hit this gigantic frog splash to seal the deal. The Street Profits are the new Raw Tag Team Champions. Seth demanded a rematch at the pay-per-view. He said Kevin Owens, he can name the time, name the place, name the stipulation, and he will crucify him. I'm sure that'll be a WrestleMania. As far as this match goes, I got Street Profits retaining. Rollins is headed for a singles match with Owens, clearly. There's no need to put the tag team belts back on him. So Street Profits to retain. Andrade, back from his suspension, defends his United States Championship against Humberto Carrillo. Again, yes, Carrillo gets another championship match. It's like Batista in 2006. All the world title shots that he got on SmackDown, it was comical. It was comical. The number of World Heavyweight Championship matches that Batista... It's almost like when he finally did win the title. What's so impressive about it? If you're just going to feed title shot after title shot after title shot to the same person over and over again, you're going to win one eventually. A blind squirrel is going to find a nut if you give it enough chances. I feel like that's what's going on here with Carrillo. Carrillo's getting this shot. He pinned Andrade in a tag team match on Monday night. A very enjoyable match. It was Humberto and Rey Mysterio taking on Andrade and Angel Garza. Angel Garza kissed someone's grandmother in the front row before the match. He's kissing everybody. He's got to be careful now with this coronavirus. He shouldn't be going around kissing people. I'm going to say Carrillo wins the championship. I'm picking Humberto Carrillo to win the United States Championship. He wins it here, and my prediction is that he then drops it at WrestleMania. They're going to do a four-way with, you know, Rey Mysterio and Andrade and Angel Garza and Humberto, and at WrestleMania, Garza is going to win the U.S. title. Carrillo's going to win it here. He's going to be a transitional champion, and Garza will win the championship at WrestleMania. That's my early prediction, and that could be the eventual catalyst for a storyline split between Andrade and Garza and Zelina Vega. You know, but Carrillo should win it here, because if they're going to do that, they're going to do that four-way at WrestleMania. He should win the championship here. Because ask yourself this question, and I always make this mistake. I know I'm a glutton for punishment by even using the word sense, using the words common sense in a sentence together when it comes to WWE. I know. It's a flaw that I have. I can't help it. But what sense would it make for Carrillo to lose here again, but get another shot at WrestleMania? Why? Just because they want to get everybody on the show? There should be a reason. If he loses here, there's no reason for him to sniff that U.S. title ever again. So I would have him win it here and get the belt onto Garza at WrestleMania. Garza is the future. Get that championship onto him. Braun Strowman defends his Intercontinental Championship in a 3-on-1 handicap match against Shinsuke Nakamura, Cesaro, and I guess the returning Sami Zayn. We haven't seen Sami in a match in a very long time. They had a moment of bliss on SmackDown this week with the NWO. The NWO was being inducted this year into the WWE Hall of Fame. It is Hulk Hogan, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, and Sean Waltman. Hulk Hogan was not there tonight. Hall, Nash, and Waltman were. They came out in their NWO gear. So think about this. We have Jake the Snake making an appearance on TNT this week, and Scott Hall making an in-ring appearance on Fox, both in the span of 48 hours. DDP is a miracle worker. I'm sure he was watching like a proud papa this week. This does not happen without him. My observations from this moment of bliss, Nash. Nash is still a unit out there. This guy just towers over everybody. I mean, Braun Strowman is a big dude, and he's clearly a little bit taller at this point than Nash. I'm sure Nash used to be a little bit taller, even than he still is. But yeah, he's had surgeries, knee surgery. The guy's literally had 20-some-odd knee surgeries, going back to his basketball days. I'm sure he's lost a couple of inches as he's gotten older. He's still a big guy, though. I mean, he still towers over everybody. And Wallman looked like they could sign him to a contract tomorrow, and he could still go if he wanted to. I'm sure Goldberg was thrilled about Scott Hall laughing at him on television and poking fun at the taser incident from his Starrcade match with Nash back in 98 when Nash ended Goldberg's streak. Goldberg and Scott Hall, for those who don't know, they do not get along. They do not like each other at all. Or at least I know Goldberg hates Scott Hall. I shouldn't say, I'm pretty sure Scott Hall is not exactly Goldberg's biggest fan either. I know the hate at least comes from the Goldberg side. Goldberg hates Scott Hall. He does not like Scott Hall. They worked together in WCW. And look, I'm sure Goldberg saw Hall do some shit. And Hall probably, or said some shit. Scott Hall was probably a dick back then. And Goldberg probably has every right to feel the way that he feels about Scott Hall. But he is not fond of Scott Hall. So I'm sure Hall sitting there laughing at Goldberg probably wasn't his favorite moment. That is, if Goldberg was even watching the show. He certainly wasn't on the show. Neither was Roman Reigns. I guess no reason for them to be. Then neither one of them are on the pay-per-view. This is the go-home show to the pay-per-view. A pay-per-view that they're not even on. So why should they be on the show? But I'm watching this. I'm watching this segment with Alexa Bliss and Nikki Cross, and they're interviewing the NWO. And I'm thinking to myself, we've got Goldberg back on top as the champion. And Hall and Nash are on TV in their NWO gear, mocking Goldberg for getting one over on him. Like, what year is it again? What year am I in? Strowman's winning this. Maybe Sami Zayn will make it entertaining. I'm not a big fan of these handicap matches. I'm not a big fan of the idea of Cesaro and Nakamura losing to somebody in a handicap match in a three-on-one situation. Strowman's going to win. And my expectation and prediction is that he goes on to WrestleMania to defend the championship against Sheamus. Sheamus, you know, the Intercontinental title is the one title, as Sheamus has said. I mean, I don't know if he's been Universal Champion. I guess maybe he hasn't been, but it's one of the only titles that he has yet to win in a company where he has pretty much held every other achievement that you could think of. WWE Champion, World Champion, U.S. Champion, multiple-time Tag Team Champion, King of the Ring, Royal Rumble, Money in the Bank. This guy's done it all. Except the Intercontinental title. He's talking about this a few weeks ago, how important it would be to him to win the championship. He's got no obvious next opponent. Have a big hoss match between him and Strowman at WrestleMania and give the IC belt to Sheamus. Why not? AJ Styles takes on Aleister Black. No disqualification rules. They were supposed to have a match on Monday night, and they did technically, but not the kind of match that we were expecting. Before the match, AJ was annoyed by comments from Mark Wahlberg, who was promoting his new movie. And they must have said, hey, can you read some dialogue here that we can use on WWE television? It was one of these press junket things where the actor sits around and a whole bunch of media people come in throughout the day to interview him about their movie. So they had him read some dialogue. And in this clip that they played, he suggested that AJ Styles just walk away from The Undertaker. This is not a fight that you want. Just walk away. And AJ was beside himself. He couldn't believe that he was getting advice now from Marky Mark. He's already got to face a Mark at WrestleMania. Now he's getting advice from Marky Mark. You ever see the movie Fear? Don't fuck with Marky Mark. I'd be more afraid of him than I would be of The Undertaker. Great movie. He said Undertaker is trying to hold on to the spotlight. A spotlight that isn't his anymore. Now the spotlight belongs to AJ Styles. Damn straight. Damn straight. Damn straight. The 54-year-old needs to step aside and make room for the 42-year-old. Damn straight. Difference is, of course, the 42-year-old can still go. I can't say the same, unfortunately, for the 54-year-old. AJ forced Alistair to go through Carl Anderson and Luke Gallows first, just for the right to get to him. So, another gauntlet-type situation. As I said before, WWE sure does love their gauntlets. So the OC was going to force Aleister Black to run the gauntlet in order to get to AJ here. This was not as good as the gauntlet on SmackDown, I will say that. When he finally did get to AJ, AJ beat him with the phenomenal forearm, and he crossed Aleister's arms across his chest to pin him like The Undertaker does. So now they're going to have a no disqualification match, which would seem to invite interference from Anderson and Gallows, which is why I think Undertaker either shows up or his dong does, you know, it goes off to distract AJ and cost him the win, with the idea being that AJ can lose now because I hope he'll get his win back over The Undertaker at WrestleMania, although that's not a sure thing. So Aleister Black is my pick to win here. It could end up being a handicap match at WrestleMania. I'm not so sure that wouldn't be the smarter way to go. Instead of doing I know the bigger marquee match is AJ Styles and The Undertaker one-on-one, but it's a match that is at least 5 years too late. Realistically, it's 10 years too late, but it's a match that's at least 5 years too late. Undertaker in a singles match is a dangerous proposition. The only singles match I want to see The Undertaker in at this point is his retirement match. And we know this is not going to be his retirement match. I'm holding out hope because time-wise it would be kind of cool if they timed it with the Survivor Series in November, because it's going to be 30 years to the day, to the very pay-per-view that The Undertaker debuted in 1990. If ever there was a place to do it, that would be it. And it could be Undertaker against Aleister Black. Maybe this is sort of an early seed being planted if they want to do something with the both of them where they team up at WrestleMania. 3-on-2, handicap match, to take on all three members of the OC. Now that would change my prediction for WrestleMania if that were to happen. I don't see Aleister Black and The Undertaker losing if they are a tag team. But in a singles match, AJ Styles should Styles clash Undertaker on his fucking face and win. Undertaker also wins, it pains me to even say the word sad tweet and Undertaker in the same sentence, because The Undertaker should not be tweeting, it just feels wrong, but he wins for sad tweet of the week. WWE.com posted a gallery of photos this week in honor of some of the greatest women to ever hold a championship either in WWE or on the NXT brand. This was in honor of Women's History Month. And it did not go unnoticed by The Undertaker's wife, the former women's champion herself, Michelle McCool, that she was not included on this list. She was not included in this gallery of images. She was snubbed. So, she took to Twitter, and she had this to say. Real talk. When you've put up with more in the past than anyone would believe, simply because I am The Undertaker's wife, have rarely been mentioned for making any contribution to the women's revolution, but wow, not even the top 45. Hashtag zero talent. For the record, not a shot at any girl on this list. Respect to all. Just felt the urge to speak up and remind all to know your worth. Don't let anyone tell you differently. Afterthought? Nope. You are worthy. Hashtag real talk. So WWE.com later updated the gallery to include Michelle McCool, and they threw a few other names in there that were left out, like Bull Nakano, but The Undertaker was having none of it, or at least whoever is running The Undertaker's Twitter account. It is an official account. It's got the blue check mark. Doesn't mean Undertaker has the Twitter app on his phone, though, and is actually doing the tweeting from for his own account. So I have a theory about this. My theory is that his wife has control over his account and either forgot that she was logged into it or just posted on his behalf. But I could be wrong. It could very well be. It could very well have been that The Undertaker himself, who said, was fed up with this. And what he tweeted was, "Too little, too late, unbelievable," with 2 exclamation points. Mind you, The Undertaker had not tweeted anything prior to this tweet since September of last year. But this ruffled his underfeathers so much that he just felt the need to respond. Undertaker stands by his lady. And finally, we have the Raw Women's Elimination Chamber match. I guess this is the de facto main event on Sunday for the right to challenge Becky Lynch at WrestleMania. Shayna Baszler, Asuka, Natalya, Liv Morgan, Ruby Riott, and Sarah Logan. Asuka was to have wrestled Shayna on Monday night. She has a wrist injury. She had hurt her wrist at a live event the night before. She was not cleared, and so Kairi Sane took her place. These two had a great NXT Women's Championship match at TakeOver Brooklyn a couple of years ago, Shayna and Kairi. Unfortunately, this was not that match. This was not the same match. This was meant to be a showcase for Shayna Baszler. Shayna Baszler is new to Monday Night Raw. It was her first match on the show, officially. She was toying with Kairi basically the entire time. All of a sudden, Elton John walked out in the middle of the match to join the announce team. Or maybe it was Becky Lynch, I don't know. Elton John wouldn't come within 50 feet of this show, that I can tell you. Maybe we should start calling her the Rocket Man, Becky Lynch. She's wearing a fur coat, she's got the oversized sunglasses, she took Jerry Lawler's crown, she put it on her head. The fans in Brooklyn did not give a shit about this match. There were chants of boring. Shayna got the win with the Karafuta Clutch. In a separate match on the show Monday night, Liv Morgan, another chamber participant, she pinned Ruby Riott after a fast count by Sarah Logan. Sarah Logan was serving as the special referee. After the match, Liv knocked down Ruby, Sarah knocked down Liv. I don't care at all about the Riott Squad drama. I just want the chamber to come down to Asuka and Shayna. Now, this is assuming Asuka gets cleared. It's possible that Asuka's still injured and hasn't been cleared. You know, if she can't go, I guess they could always replace her with Kairi. I was shocked that she wasn't in the chamber to begin with. Why is Natty in there? I think Kairi beat Natty on TV a few weeks ago, yet Natty is in the chamber, but not Kairi Sane. But if Asuka can't go, you know, whether they put all due respect, and I like Kairi, but if Asuka can't be there, if she's not cleared, then this match takes a very sharp turn right into the toilet. I'm not all that interested in it to begin with. We already know who's going to win. It's like the Roman Reigns thing. But if Asuka's hurt and she can't be part of this match, then I've lost all interest in even bothering with this. The easy prediction, Shayna wins. I mean, it's the easiest pick for me to make on this entire show. I think we must all be in agreement, I would hope. Shayna Baszler wins, goes on to face Becky Lynch. Or does she? Because there was a report in this week's Wrestling Observer that Vince McMahon was very negative on Baszler's match with Kairi Sane on Monday night. It didn't get a good reaction, he thought, which it was heel against heel. Kairi Sane is a heel. Shayna Baszler is a heel. What was he expecting? People in the crowd to be cheering wildly? To be doing, slapping high fives and doing cartwheels? What was he expecting? According to the report, he felt that she also did not come off as someone worthy of being a WrestleMania headliner. Well, you know, hey, her match with Becky ain't headlining WrestleMania this year, so that shouldn't even be an issue. Was the woman's first match on the show. It was her first match on Monday Night Raw. There is no one else outside of possibly Asuka. And even Asuka has already lost to Becky Lynch. That's done. No one else in this match who belongs with Becky at WrestleMania. Ruby Riott just came back. She's a good wrestler. I like Ruby, but Ruby Riott should not be challenging Becky Lynch as a marquee match for the championship at WrestleMania. Talk to me in a year. Not now. Shayna Baszler is the only choice. She bit a chunk of this woman's neck off. You don't give up on Shayna Baszler after one bad night. Now, I will say, her match at Survivor Series wasn't great either. That was the triple threat with Becky and Bayley and Shayna, and Shayna went over. I think it's unfair to put all of that on Shayna, though, and she came right back in NXT a month later and had a fantastic match when she dropped the championship, the NXT Women's Championship, to Rhea Ripley. I love that match. Give her time. She's new to the brand. A lot of people aren't familiar with her. Her style is different. Her style is more mat-based and submission-based. Give her time. But if this report is to be believed and he does end up giving up on Shayna Baszler, let that be a lesson. Let this be a lesson to every single one of those men and women waiting in the wings for their big moment, for their big call-up in NXT, outside of a few not named Rhea Ripley. Let this be a lesson to them about what future awaits them. You know what I think the real problem is here? I'll tell you right now what I think the problem is. The problem is I don't think Shayna is blonde enough for Vince McMahon's liking. She needs to dye her hair blonde before WrestleMania. That way Vince will give her all the belts. Problem solved. But that's the whole pay-per-view. That's the card as it stands right now. I thought maybe they would announce some kind of a... Yeah, they love their contract signings. Do a contract signing with Roman and Goldberg just to get them on the show. Nope. A lot of big names are missing. Randy Orton and Edge, they're going to shoot their angle on Monday night. You know, so it's a very underwhelming Elimination Chamber card. Probably the most underwhelming maybe that they've ever put together, to be perfectly honest with you. But sometimes you go into these shows that have low expectations and they impress you. When the bar is set so low, sometimes you have a pay-per-view that comes along and it really just blows you away and turns out to be an excellent show. Maybe this will be one of those shows. I'm going to be live streaming when it's over, good, bad, or ugly. Whatever it ends up being, I'm going to be live on YouTube as soon as the Elimination Chamber goes off the air this Sunday. So probably around 10:30 or sometime between 10:30 and 11 p.m. Sunday night, join me live on YouTube. And we'll recap the entire show. Again, the last big WWE event on the way to WrestleMania. And hopefully there will be a WrestleMania. As I am recording this, there have been a lot of events in different parts of the country that are being canceled. I saw today South by Southwest. Huge event. Huge conference down in Austin, Texas. Canceled. Because of fears about the coronavirus. This is the first time in 34 years that South by Southwest will not be taking place. And from what I read, it would have pumped something like $350 million into the local economy. Way more than WrestleMania usually pumps into the local economy in the host city. And with South by Southwest, there were a lot of vendors that had already pulled out over safety concerns. So, you know, realistically, the organizers were probably pushed into making the final decision to cancel. I'm sure that's the last thing they wanted to do. But it goes to show that if there is enough pressure applied by government, local officials, the same fate could potentially await an event like WrestleMania. I think the mayor is the one who made the decision, and that really is what it's going to come down to. I have been of the opinion, as a lot of you have and probably still are, WrestleMania ain't going to be canceled. Vince McMahon will never allow WrestleMania to be canceled. Literally, one of his own performers fell to his death in his own ring during a live pay-per-view, and the show went on. And Vince McMahon stands to lose a lot more money by canceling WrestleMania. It will not be his decision. If WrestleMania does end up being canceled or something dramatic happens, and I still don't think it's going to happen, but if it does, it's not going to be his decision. It's going to be a decision that's either forces their hand or it's made by local officials. A lot can happen in the next few weeks. You know, we still have a month to go. It's already wreaking havoc with a lot of the Japanese promotions. So who's to say what's going to happen with WrestleMania? That's going to be a very interesting situation to follow. Because every day brings announcements of new cancellations of big sporting events. Some places are doing it in empty arenas. Can you imagine WrestleMania in an empty stadium? They're going to go to Raymond James Stadium and just have an empty stadium show. That would be interesting. That would be an interesting WrestleMania with no fans. John Cena has a match at WrestleMania this year. You think his spot calling is bad in a packed building? Wait until you hear John Cena calling spots in an empty stadium against The Fiend. Just to piggyback on what I just got done talking about there, they have already declared a state of emergency here in the state of New York over the whole coronavirus thing. And last night, I was watching parts of the Stardom show. Remember I told you guys a few weeks ago that Stardom, the all-women's promotion over in Japan, had canceled some events, and they were running a big event this weekend in an empty arena. No fans, just some, you know, you could see staff in the background and media people were at ringside shooting pictures and stuff, but no fans. And I didn't watch the entire show. I didn't have time to watch the whole thing. But it's up for free on their YouTube channel right now if you want to check it out. It is a weird thing. From what I saw, it was still a very good show. As is usually the case with Stardom, I hear a lot of good things about Stardom shows. But they just did a show in an empty arena. You know, because of the concerns over the whole situation, they are not taking any chances. They're heeding the advice of their, you know, health officials and local officials and doing what they feel they have to do to not just protect the audience, but to protect themselves and to protect their own talent. So I was of the mindset, as a lot of you probably still are, that, hey, there's no chance it's going to really have any kind of effect like that on WrestleMania. You know what? I'm not so sure anymore. For all the reasons I just mentioned. It may not be their call to make. A few quick shout-outs here to wrap up before we move on. Big Papa Slop, Dan Leopold, thank you. I hope Natalie is doing well, by the way. And shout-out to Dan's friend, Jason Linick, who is expecting daughter number two. So congrats to Jason. I like your name. Alvin loves his wife, Angelique. He said that his wife's takeaways from Monday Night Raw this past week were that she loves Seth Rollins, Riddick Moss's muscles have muscles, AJ Styles has super shiny hair, and Ruby Riott looks like a peacock. Nothing about the spider, eh? I thought for sure she'd have some kind of thought about the spider. I'm going to get to the spider a little bit later. And finally here, Jimmy, shout out to him. He has a new YouTube channel called Jobbed Out. That's J-O-B, apostrophe D. Make sure you put the apostrophe in there. It's very important. The show was originally an audio series for a number of years. They tackled wrestling, all kinds of wrestling topics and issues. And after a 3-year hiatus, it lives again, this time on YouTube. So they talk controversial topics. They do list videos like wrestlers who also acted in Oscar-nominated films and just tons of other stuff. So make sure you search J-O-B, apostrophe D, Jobbed Out Wrestling on YouTube, and it should come right up for you. He's got some cool videos up from years ago that he did interviews with folks like Jim Duggan, Terry Runnels. There's a Jake the Snake interview that's up on that channel right now, filmed about a month or so before DDP finally got to Jake and started him on his path to DDP yoga and getting clean and sober and really just saving the guy's life. And the difference in looking, just physically looking at Jake then and now, is like night and day. So anyway, check it out, Jobbed Out Wrestling on YouTube. After midnight on March 2nd, one day after his WWE contract expired, Matt Hardy went on his YouTube channel and he announced that he was taking a break from WWE. Now, he never announced a new destination for himself. He did say that he was going to take some time to watch all of the different wrestling shows, all the wrestling programming that's out there. He wanted to get caught up on everything. And he proceeded to name every show, which when you hear someone out loud mention the name of every show, that's when it really sinks in, like, shit, there's a lot of wrestling on TV these days. So he mentioned he's going to watch Raw, he's going to watch SmackDown, he's going to watch NXT, NWA Power, Impact Wrestling, Ring of Honor, MLW Fusion, New Japan, AEW Dark, AEW Dynamite. Don't forget there's another AEW show coming later this year. I don't believe it's Dark, I think it's a totally new show. Now, if he is going to AEW, and that's, I mean, I don't feel any differently than I felt a week ago, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, that he's going to AEW. I guess he couldn't have said that even if he knew that he was, or if he signed something, because it would have raised tampering concerns. If, you know, he had signed immediately, or they had vignettes ready to go for him, you know. Why announce it at all? That would be my question, you know. Why even announce where he's going to go? You know, let's say he does sign with them. Why announce it? Let it be a surprise. He says with WWE, it wasn't about the money. He wanted to stay. He would have loved to have stayed in WWE. The money wasn't the issue. They're just on different pages, him and Vince McMahon, creatively. And he wants to maximize what he sees as really these last 3 to 4 years that he has as an active performer. And he said he knows one day he's going to be back in WWE. And one day he and his brother are going to be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame. He knows that. Says there's no burn bridges, he just had to take a break. Now WWE, for its part, and they don't do this with everybody, they took the high road and put a statement out that read Matt Hardy's contract with WWE has expired. A trailblazer throughout his 19-year career, Matt and his brother Jeff pioneered the first tag team ladder matches, TLC matches, stealing the show at WrestleMania on several occasions. And Matt, who competed in his first WWE match in 1994, captured 9, and I did think that was an interesting line to include. And that this could be just me fishing for the skeptic in me fishing for some kind of conspiracy theory that isn't there. But it reminds me of Montreal in 97 when Bret Hart was, he had just been introduced and he's at ringside. And I think he was putting his glasses on some kid at ringside before the match with Shawn Michaels. And on commentary, unbeknownst to Bret, Jim Ross is talking about how it took a long time to put this match together. It took 18 months to get it done. And I think his exact words were, you know, and the betting line is, or the belief is, something like that, is that you will never, ever see it again. Which, who knows if Bret knew that that's what he was saying on commentary. But in the course of talking about Bret, he was talking about when he made his debut. And I think he said he made his debut in 1976 or whatever year it was. It was almost like highlighting how old this guy was, you know? And there were people who pointed that out even then, you know? It just seemed weird, you know? Like, clearly they knew, Bret didn't know, that that was going to be the last appearance he'd be making on television. So it was kind of weird to hear JR saying some of the things he was saying. But I remember him pointing out, oh, he made his debut in 1970-something. Like, hey, you know, talk about dating the guy. And here they're talking about, Matt had his first match in 1994. Like, okay. I'm sure, look, this is probably just something that, the dot-com people were told to put together. But I don't know. I just thought it was weird. But it goes into all of his different accomplishments and titles won and everything. And it was a very positive statement. It was a very positive statement on WWE's part. They wished him well and all the best in his future endeavors. So, you know, kudos to WWE. They didn't have to say anything where they could have been, petty about it in some way. And they put a nice statement together. And look, it's a mutual parting of the ways. They could not come to an understanding. I'm sure they'll do business together at some point down the road. And Matt just felt it's time to move on. Which brings us to Being the Elite, Free the Delete. Free the Delete is that new YouTube series that Matt started a number of weeks ago. It's about 10 episodes in now. And now we're starting to see a lot of the tie-ins between these two shows. There was an episode of Free the Delete from a month ago where Matt called somebody on the phone. He's at the Hardy compound outside his house. He's frantically calling somebody on his cell phone in the final, 10 seconds probably of the video, and he asks, is he there with you? And then it cuts off. Well, fast forward to the most recent episode of Being the Elite, and there's a scene at the end where Matt Jackson gets a call on his cell from a North Carolina area code, and he tells his brother, you know, he doesn't tell his brother who it was or anything, he just says, we have to make a quick stop. Never says where they're headed or why. We got to make a quick stop. Then on the latest Free the Delete that Matt Hardy put out, we see this SUV pulling up to the Hardy estate. And out at the end of the video comes the Young Bucks, Matt and Nick Jackson. And Matt Hardy says, you know, oh, Bucks of Youth, I knew you'd come. And the video cuts off. So there's an ongoing storyline here. He's obviously headed to AEW. They know where they're going with this. Matt has said that this story is going to continue to play itself out on the YouTube shows. The only question is, when are we going to see him and in what role? So if he goes to AEW, you know, I honestly don't think Matt is best utilized as just put him out there as a wrestler, just wrestling matches every week. Now, he doesn't have to worry about being on the road as often with AEW because they don't have house shows. They don't have live events. Maybe he works out some kind of deal with AEW where he can appear in other promotions. There are some people that have special deals, you know. People, you see the Lucha Bros and certain acts in the company are not exclusive to AEW. The Lucha Bros are still wrestling all over the place. I don't even know that they have a true full-time deal with AEW. Or maybe they do, but AEW has, you know, first preference, but they're still wrestling in other places. Who's to say Matt doesn't end up popping up in NWA? Or popping up in ROH for an appearance? Who's to say? So I'm very curious what his role ends up being. It may not be as the exalted one. They sure want you to think that. They want you to believe that he's the exalted one, the leader of the Dark Order. AEW posted a tweet overnight yesterday, this weird message. The first letter of each sentence, when you piece the letters together, forms the name Matt Hardy. So they're making it very obvious right now. But they were doing this with Chris Daniels, and it was all just one big swerve. So who's to say that this isn't one big swerve with Matt? But it seems pretty obvious that he's on his way in. Now, Matt's brother Jeff made an appearance on WWE Backstage on Tuesday night, told Renee Young that he has been cleared to return to the ring. He's been backstage at SmackDown each of the last 3 weeks, but not used and not seen on television. They're not teasing his, unless those glitches have something to do with Jeff Hardy, and I don't know what that would be. I don't think that has anything to do with him. No vignettes, no nothing, but he's been backstage each of the last 3 weeks. He has not wrestled a match since April of last year. Almost one full year out after knee surgery and the other issues that obviously he has been dealing with. But that was around the time that he and Matt won the SmackDown Tag Team titles. And I don't think they had the chance to defend them once. They almost immediately, within a few weeks, had to vacate them because of Jeff's injury. And then he went under the knife in May. He was arrested for public intoxication in July. And then in October, he was arrested again, this time for driving while impaired. That was the DWI arrest. That the cops spotted him coming out of a liquor store, and they were following him. Obviously, there was something that made them think, hey, we got to follow this guy. He comes out of the liquor store, gets in his car, and they see him swerving all over the road. So they pull him over, and he admits to having two shots of vodka. He wouldn't cooperate on taking a breathalyzer. He would not submit a blood sample. A judge had to sign off on a search warrant to allow the cops to take a blood sample from him. And at the time, the story said that his driver's license was revoked, pending a resolution of that case. Now, he's due back in court the day after WrestleMania on those charges. That case is still pending. It's not over yet. He's due back in court the day after WrestleMania on April 6th. So I'm not even sure. Honestly, I would be very surprised if we saw him back on TV before then. If they feel like this is just a formality and he's not going to go to jail, he's going to make an appearance or pay a fine, he'll be okay. If they're confident in that, then I suppose if they really want him on WrestleMania and the Battle Royal or something, maybe we'll see him. But I would be very surprised if we see him back on TV before WrestleMania, because they would, you would think, want to make sure that that situation is resolved. They've got their WrestleMania card probably already booked anyway. Pretty late in the game to throw Jeff Hardy on WrestleMania. So it's possible they just hold out until after the pay-per-view and see how this thing, you know, plays itself out. He said that he checked himself into inpatient rehab for the first time after that incident back in October. He said he's doing much better now. He looked good. Said he's doing much better now. And look, that's great to hear. But he may still have to face the music on that DWI. This was not his first DWI in the state of North Carolina. He's not a first-time offender. His last one was 2 years ago, and he got a suspended jail sentence and had to pay a fine. This was his second offense. So it is possible that he may end up having to serve some time behind bars. Now, even if he does, I can't imagine it would be a very long time. It could be a matter of days or weeks. But if he doesn't, then you know what? He should consider himself very lucky. There should be zero tolerance for repeat offenders when it comes to drunk driving. I don't care if you're a celebrity or a Joe Schmo like you and I. No wiggle room, zero tolerance if you are a repeat offender. Some people would say if you're a first-time offender. But I, you know, look, I get people make mistakes. People do stupid things sometimes. They have one drink too many or a shot of this, a shot of that. If you are a repeat offender and you're getting behind the wheel of a car and you're impaired and you're swerving all over the place, I have no sympathy for people like that. They need to pay a price. Now, JBL also appeared on Backstage. He was officially announced for the WWE Hall of Fame, class of 2020. Raj Giri of Wrestling Inc. was the first to report that news weeks ago that JBL would be inducted, so this was no big surprise. We're still waiting on the final announcements of Jushin Thunder Liger and the British Bulldog going in, the other two names that were rumored. All the other rumored names so far have come to pass, so I assume these two are pretty rock solid, but not official yet. And we now know that the next inductee, possibly one of those two, that name will be revealed this week on Corey Graves's After the Bell podcast. So they're going very low-key with these Hall of Fame announcements, right? They broke this announcement on Backstage on FS1 at 11 o'clock at night on a Tuesday, which had an audience this week, I think, of 56,000 people. When the first rating came out, it was 18,000. That was the overnight viewership of WWE Backstage. And I thought to myself, it's got to be a mistake. It does not sound like a real number. It is impossible for me to believe. And the numbers, to have that kind of drop from one week to the next, impossible. So then we come to find out that was not the number. That was the replay number, I think at 2 a.m. And the original airing wasn't much better. I mean, it was higher, but it still wasn't a great number. 56,000 is not a great number, but it wasn't 18,000. But they're breaking the announcement on there. They're going to break the announcement on Corey's podcast. And it just feels like, after Batista and the NWO, it's almost like all of this other... Oh, they had the Bellas. I'm sorry. They had the Bella Twins on SmackDown. So they got the SmackDown on Fox treatment. Last year, Vice debuted a new wrestling series, a docuseries called Dark Side of the Ring. And I reviewed a lot of those episodes here on the Sound Off. There was one on the murder of Bruiser Brody, which just got me so angry watching that. It was a great show, but just angering when you kind of recap what happened in that incident. The Von Erich family, which that whole family is a tragedy. The death of Gino Hernandez, Fabulous Moolah, a lot of good ones. A lot of good topics they covered last year, and I really enjoyed the series. And so did a lot of other people, because Vice picked it up for a second season. And now we have a premiere date for that second season. It is coming back on Tuesday, March 24th, at 9 p.m. Eastern, which will be a two-hour premiere. It's a double episode covering the Benoit family murder-suicide. Each week thereafter, the show will air on Tuesdays at 10 p.m. with Chris Jericho as the narrator for this season. He replaces Dutch Mantel, who narrated season one. They're going to have actor and comedian Chris Gethard will be hosting a new after show at 11 p.m. each week following each new episode. With a rotating panel of guests from the world, I guess, of wrestling and entertainment. They're going to talk about each episode after it airs. So very similar to what AMC does with Chris Hardwick hosting Talking Dead after every episode of The Walking Dead. He did the same thing with Breaking Bad. They called it Talking Bad. Very original. But I guess we're getting the after-show treatment for Dark Side of the Ring this year. The other eight episodes this season, I wanted to just run through the list here and give a little background on each. All of them are going to be, I believe all of them are an hour each. The list is as follows. Now, this is not in any kind of air date order. So this order I'm reading this in doesn't mean anything. I'm just listing the different topics. Owen Hart. Owen Hart is getting an episode on this season. They interviewed his widow, Martha, for this special. That one and the Benoit one are going to be tough to get through, because of the subject matter, but also because I think a lot of us, myself included, we live through those times as fans. And so we all have our own memories of watching when it happened, or in the case of the Benoit stuff, kind of where you were when you read the news, and it just tore your guts up. You know, I can't imagine if you were actually a friend or a family member, what they must have been going through at that time. But the Owen Hart thing especially, I'll never forget that night for the rest of my life, or that walk home from my friend's house. Lived six blocks away from me. I was over at his house watching Over the Edge that night. And when the pay-per-view was over, I had a walk. It was a long walk home that night at 11 o'clock. And I remember walking in and, in the house, my brother had the local NBC newscast on. My mother was home too. They both were watching the news. It was right at 11 p.m. when the evening news comes on. And it was the lead story. Here in New York, I mean, this happened in, where were they? St. Louis? Kiel Center in St. Louis, I think. And it was the lead story probably across the country on a lot of newscasts at 11 p.m. And I remember walking in and seeing that. I just lost it. You know, once reality had really set in that he was really dead, and just how stupid and how senseless it all was. And having met the guy, you know, less than a year before that, I just started lost it. And two little kids lost their father over a dumb stunt. So that's going to be a tough one to watch. New Jack. They've got to talk about the mass transit incident in ECW. I don't know for sure that they will, but I think it would be almost impossible for them not to at least mention it. How can they not? But in the trailer for the season, there's like a 60-second trailer on YouTube with different highlights from some of the episodes. In the trailer, they show footage, and the real focus is on the time that New Jack tried to murder Vic Grimes by tossing him off the scaffold at that XPW show. There can be no doubt his intent that night was to either badly injure or kill Vic Grimes. So, some backstory here. The two of them had worked a match together in ECW. ECW had a pay-per-view, I don't remember which one it was, but in 2000, there was an ECW pay-per-view, and there was a match involving New Jack and Vic Grimes. And they're up on a scaffold. The scaffold seems to be the common denominator here. And I don't know if it was actually a scaffold match, or if they just ended up on a scaffold, but they're up on a scaffold, and they're both supposed to fall off together. I guess that's the spot, that was the plan. They're going to fall off at the same time. Grimes is a big guy. He gets cold feet. Says, I can't do it. So New Jack grabs him. New Jack is hardly the most understanding person in the world. He grabs Vic Grimes and he forces him off. And they both go flying off the scaffold. And they miss the tables that were set up down below. And they crash onto the floor, right onto the pavement. And in the process, Vic Grimes, who was a very large man, he landed right on top of New Jack's head. So as if the fall itself wasn't bad enough, you've got this guy who's probably every bit of, I don't know, 350, 400, whatever he was, landing right on top of your head. He should have died. New Jack should have died on that fall. And he has said in interviews, he's claimed that he went blind in one eye because of that fall. He's been blind in that eye ever since. Anyway, fast forward a couple of years. ECW is dead. It's 2002, maybe 2003. They meet again in XPW, which is that's probably a whole other segment on the history of XPW over there. But you can search for the match online. New Jack versus Vic Grimes. This is an infamous incident. I remember seeing highlights of this years ago, and I just couldn't understand how this guy was not 6 feet under. They're up on a scaffold again. Stacks of tables are down below in the ring. I mean stacks, like two towers of tables have been set up down below in the ring to cushion the fall. These guys are so high up. They are way up there, scary high above the ring. And New Jack has not forgotten that Vic Grimes hesitated that night and fell on his head and blinded him in one eye, even though he didn't do it on purpose. So he grabs Vic Grimes to toss him off, which I guess was the plan, but he intentionally overshoots him with the intent of trying to either maim the guy or to kill him. I've heard him say that he wanted Grimes to land on the ring post and either break his back or snap his neck. I absolutely 100% believe that New Jack wanted to kill this man, because New Jack is a fucking psychopath. Now, if you watch it back, you know, all these years, almost 20 years later, I still cannot believe that Vic Grimes did not die on that fall. I mean, he had a guardian angel looking over him that night. One of the scariest things in wrestling that I have ever seen. And this is coming from somebody who watched all of Monday Night Raw in 2019. One of the scariest things in wrestling that I have ever seen. Now, I don't know if they'll cover the mass transit incident in ECW, but that New Jack special is going to be something else. The things he's done to people in matches, I know people love to glorify, oh, it's New Jack, you know. The things that he has done to people in some of the matches that he's been in, far worse than even the mass transit stuff. He should have gone to jail for some of the shit that he pulled over the years. Then we have the death of Dino Bravo. This may be the one that I'm looking forward to the most. We first heard rumors about this last year that they wanted the Dino Bravo episode, I think, to be part of season one. But they had already started working on it. This is before they knew that there was going to be a season two. So this has been in the works for a very long time. And I'm looking forward to this one. I remember my memory of Dino Bravo is from his time, probably like a lot of you, in WWE in the late 80s and the early 90s. And then he just disappeared. He vanished. And a few years later, he is shot to death at home while watching television, execution style. He's executed. 17 times he was shot. I really hope they interviewed Rick Martel for this. Martel did a shoot years ago. And there's a few floating around with Rick Martel, but Martel doesn't really do a lot of interviews. He doesn't do a lot of shoots. He doesn't do a lot of interviews. He doesn't make a lot of appearances. My understanding is, I don't know if he's in real estate or what he's doing, but he got out of wrestling. He made a clean break many years ago and, you know, found another career for himself and is very happy doing that. He did make an appearance. I know there was a WWE pay-per-view many years ago. I don't know if it was one of these Cyber Sunday shows or something. He was in the front row and I think he got physically involved. But you never see him brought in for any of these like Legends Reunion type appearances, WrestleMania. He's not in the Hall of Fame. He absolutely deserves a Hall of Fame nod. But he seems to have pretty much made a clean break from the business and is doing well. But there is an interview that he did a number of years ago, and I don't remember if it was RF Video or High Spots. It was one of the two. He was very good friends with Dino Bravo, and he said WWE was going to let Bravo go because they just didn't have anything for him anymore. He used up his usefulness, and they were done with him. They were going to fire him. And Rick Martel went to Pat Patterson, fellow Canadian, and he asked, look, let me tag with Dino. We could be tag team partners. And Patterson just shut the idea down. He said, we're not interested. We're done with him. You know, he wanted to become partners with Dino, he said, because he knew him well enough to know without wrestling, he had nothing. And he knew that he would fall into bad habits. Dino is the nephew, by marriage, to one of the mafia bosses up in Montreal, who would tell Dino all the time, come work for me, come work for me. So when WWF got rid of him in 92, I believe, 92 is when they let him go, what did he do? He went to work for his uncle. He didn't have any money coming in. Martel said, this is a guy who went from driving fancy cars and living this lavish lifestyle to having to borrow money from his mother. He was embarrassed. He was ashamed. He knew he could make good money working for his uncle. And that's where the stories about the illegal cigarette trade come from. I guess, the Indians own part of the river up there. He met with the Indians about smuggling cigarettes across the river. They were apparently very big wrestling fans. They knew him from TV. And they were, you know, they figured he could help attract a lot of customers. So that did very well. In fact, that did so well that it got the attention of the Coke dealers. Now they wanted in on the action. And there was a shipment that got seized. I think a shipment of cocaine that got seized by the cops. Something happened. It was sitting in a warehouse and it was supposed to be picked up for transport and it wasn't. And then like 2 or 3 days later, the cops ended up seizing it. Not long after that, he was murdered. I'm sure that's just a coincidence. But his murder remains unsolved. Martel claimed that Bravo's wife had taken their daughter to ballet class. They got home and they discovered the crime scene when they got home. She was holding their daughter. Thankfully, the daughter was sleeping. But imagine, you're the wife walking in. There's blood everywhere. There's blood on the floor. There's blood on the ceiling. The walls. The guy was shot 17 times. I've heard 10 times, 17 times, maybe 17 shots, 10 connected, something like that. But he got shot a lot. Maybe they were able to find his wife for this special. Maybe even his daughter. How old would his daughter even be by now? I don't know. She's an adult now. Maybe they were able to find them. Get interviews with them. Nobody's ever heard from them. I don't think they've ever talked publicly about what happened. But I at least hope they got Martell, because he's the only one who I've ever heard really give specific details as he knew them. Bret Hart in his book said that Dino once told him that he knew his days were numbered. It's kind of a sad story when you think about it. If this guy, wrestling was all that he had, and his own friends knew this and tried to, you know, save his job, and they were like, yeah, we don't have anything for him, we're going to get rid of him. And then he just kind of ends up in this, look, he's an adult, he's a grown man, he made his own decisions, but that's kind of sad, you know, that's a pretty sad story. So anyway, the content though, this content makes for prime, I mean, content for a TV show like this. So I am looking forward to that episode. They have one on Jimmy Snuka and the death of Nancy Argentino, his girlfriend at the time, his mistress, I should say. I've talked at length about this case here on the podcast. If you go back in the archives, he was guilty of sin. I'm sorry. He was guilty of sin. He got away with murder. There's not a doubt in my mind. I want to know what was in that damn briefcase that Snuka in his book said Vince McMahon was seen with when he showed up later on to meet with the cops at the police station. That's from Snuka himself. He put that in his book. Why he would do that, I don't know, because that just makes him look even worse. But I want to know what was in the damn briefcase. We may never know. It may end up being one of life's great mysteries. Dr. D, David Schultz, I didn't know they were working on an episode about him. He's getting an episode this season, I'm sure based around his very memorable run-in with John Stossel of 2020 back in 1984. Probably the end of 84. This was like a few months before the first WrestleMania. And it aired on 2020. Again, probably not long before WrestleMania. Stossel was backstage here in New York at Madison Square Garden, where all the big WWF shows back then were held. And he was interviewing Schultz and told him, I think this is fake. I think he did it in the context of, like, let me pose this question to you. Let me ask you a common question. A common refrain from people about professional wrestling. I think it's fake. And Schultz open hand slapped him across the ear. Both ears. He actually hit him twice. Once, I think, in the left ear, once in the right ear. It's John Stossel, so I'll allow it. He probably had it coming. Not a fan of John Stossel. So he hit him twice, and of course, he was fired for it. Maybe. He may have actually been fired for something else. You know, he may have been fired for trying to start a fight backstage with Mr. T at a time when WWE was working with Mr. T and was going to use him, wanted to use him for WrestleMania. And Schultz started some shit with him, and that actually may have been when he was really fired for, but everybody just assumes he was fired for the 2020 thing. He wasn't. If he was, he wasn't fired right away. It did not happen right away. He's always claimed that the company told him. I don't know if Vince himself did, but he said the company told him to hit Stossel. But I wonder about that. You know, you've got John Stossel, who at the time is a reporter for this news magazine show, 2020, and they've done investigative pieces on there before. What was the basis of the segment, I wonder? Were they misled into thinking they were doing some kind of puff piece on pro wrestling? I don't know that 2020 was known for their puff pieces back then. They had to know that there was a question coming like that. I would not rule out the possibility that, you know, maybe Schultz was set up. You know, maybe he was told, hey, look, if this guy asks that question, you got to put him in his place here. You got to teach him some respect about the business. Otherwise, why would you put John Stossel together with David Schultz and expect that that's going to end well? The Road Warriors, Hawk and Animal, they're getting an episode devoted to them. I don't know if it's going to focus on anything specific. It's kind of random, but there'll be a Road Warrior show. Herb Abrams, our old buddy Herb Abrams. This one's going to be interesting. I've talked about Herb before. He was quite the character. Founded the UWF promotion back in the early 90s. Not the same UWF that Bill Watts used to run. But the episode is going to look at his attempts to build a wrestling empire for himself. I mean, this is a guy who had a jobber on his TV shows named Davey Meltzer. Called him Davey Meltzer as a way to get back at Dave Meltzer for writing negative things about him in The Observer. Has there been any one person in the wrestling business, maybe outside of Vince McMahon, who has gotten more hate from people over the last 30 years than Meltzer? Holy shit. We hear his name thrown around a lot lately, and this is going back to 1990. These promoters were so gotten to by the Observer, they were naming jobbers after him on TV. And anyway, Abrams famously or infamously, he died of a heart attack. He was in police custody at the time, and he died. This was after he was found naked, covered in baby oil and grease, with cocaine all over his body. There may have been prostitutes present at the time as well. This should be fun. And last but not least, the Brawl for All. In 1998, in WWF is going to be covered as well, all of the injuries that came out of it. I know they interviewed Vince Russo at his house last year, but they never finished the episode in time for season one, so they are using it now here in season two. Honestly, this sounds like the weakest of the bunch. I can't say that I really care all that much about them talking about the Brawl for All. I think this episode to me sounds like it is to season two what the Montreal Screwjob episode was to season one. But they do a good job with these, so maybe it'll be entertaining. If there is a season three, I was thinking about what other topics would I like to see them cover. I've jotted down a few of them here. And feel free to chime in and tweet me or, you know, post on Facebook or YouTube or whatever. And let me know which subjects maybe I missed here that you think would be good subject matter. But they should cover the early 90s sex scandals in WWE. There were a bunch of those. You know, Mel Phillips, Terry Garvin, Pat Patterson. I mean, that just seems like prime content for a show like this. Vince McMahon's appearance on the Donahue Show also. All that stuff. That, I mean, you could do a two-parter on that. The steroid trial in 1994, you know, an episode on the Dynamite Kid, I think would be just brutal, given that guy's history. But he is a big figure in wrestling history. He's one of these guys that people grew up idolizing and kind of patterning themselves after. And, you know, Davey Boy may be going into the Hall of Fame solo this year. You could argue, why not Dynamite? And there's a lot of reasons why. I can understand them not wanting to put him in. But I think an episode devoted to him would be interesting. Maybe Magnum T.A.'s car accident and what might have been with him in the NWA had he never gotten hurt. The life and death of Brian Pillman, I think, could make for a fascinating episode. And that's just to name a few. I'm sure there's a whole bunch of other ones I'm not thinking of. So again, feel free to chime in if I missed any. And hopefully they can round up a bunch of interesting ones for season three. I'd like to see the show continue on. So a lot of different subjects they can cover when it comes to wrestling. A lot of dark shit that I think deserves the documentary treatment here on this series. Monday Night Raw was live from the Barclays Center in Brooklyn this past Monday. I already covered a whole bunch of Raw thoughts during my Elimination Chamber rundown, but I had a few other notes. Just wanted to run through here real quick. We did finally learn what has been inside of Eric Rowan's cage these last few weeks. And how they revealed this was No Way Jose. And I'm going to stop myself right there. You can tell how they've just given up on this storyline or it even remotely coming across like a big deal when I mention the words No Way Jose. That tells you right there. Backstage segment with No Way Jose. Death. So he's in a conga line and he congas on up to Eric Rowan and he asks him very nicely. It's like, hey, dude, you know, what's in the box, man? Or the cage, whatever. What's in the box? I feel like I'm Brad Pitt now. What's in the box? And Rowan, he says, that's all I wanted was somebody to ask respectfully. And he reaches inside and he pulls out a giant animatronic spider. And everybody freaks out and scatters. In a way, I guess it's no different than Bray Wyatt talking to puppets on TV. The only difference is they didn't spend 3 months waiting to reveal to us that he was talking to puppets. This was a giant, dumb waste of time that could get over. I am not dismissing the possibility that Rowan and that stupid spider, if he continues to bring it out to the ring with him, could get over. Let us not forget that there was a time 20 years ago when Al Snow got over with a mannequin head. Perry Saturn got over with a mop. So could Eric Rowan actually get over with a fake spider? Yeah. Am I happy with this reveal? Uh-uh. a giant, dumb waste of time. After one of the most lopsided championship matches that we have ever seen, losing to Brock Lesnar in Saudi Arabia without getting a lick of offense in, the bad luck continued this week for poor Ricochet. Poor Rick O'Shea losing to Riddick Moss in a 24/7 title match. Riddick Moss, or as the casuals who watch this show would call him, who? Ricochet lost to who on Monday night? Now, for his sake, I really want to believe that this is building to something like the Messiah taking him under his wing and bringing him into their little faction. But I have two words for you. For everybody holding out hope that this is leading to something great for Ricochet. First of all, there's actually two things to point out. Number one, this was apparently not the original plan for the show. This was a Vince McMahon change. Ricochet was not even supposed to be involved in this. I think it was going to be Riddick Moss and R-Truth. And it was Vince McMahon who put Ricochet in there. So unless Vince McMahon at the very last second came up with some great idea for Ricochet, that does not sound very promising to me. That does not sound like there's a long-term plan involved here. So that's number one. But I have two words for you. Cedric Alexander. Cedric Alexander was getting pushed for a while until Vince McMahon lost interest in him. Like Ricochet, right? He's hugely talented in the ring, not very good on promos. Ricochet is actually worse, if we're being honest here. He is not very good at all when you put a microphone in his hand. And not just in WWE. Remember, Ricochet made an appearance. What was the, was it All In? Might have been All In when Ricochet made an appearance. This was after he was trying to get out of his Lucha Underground contract still. It might have been the All In show a couple of years ago. And I think it was there. He got on the mic, and even there, it was like, ugh, it's like Cringe City. Like, he's just not a good promo at all. So it is entirely possible that he has fallen out of favor with the boss man. Now, if they start to acknowledge it on television each week, boy, he's on this losing streak, Ricochet's really down on his luck, that would seem to indicate that there's an angle here that might be leading somewhere. But in the meantime, this guy's stock has taken a gigantic hit that he may never be able to recover from. You are only as valuable as you are made out to be in the eyes of the fans. And Ricochet has never meant, and this is a fact, this is not my opinion, this is not subjective, what I'm about to say. Ricochet has never meant less than he does right now. Ever. At any point in his career since he became a star. On the independent scene, Lucha Underground, WWE, NXT, he has never meant less than he does at this exact moment. And Ricochet is a once-in-a-lifetime talent with what he can do in the ring. The things that he can do inside the ring, a once-in-a-lifetime talent. And they have broken him down and turned him to shit. Closing segment of Raw Monday Night was the best segment of the show. Beth Phoenix came to the ring to update us on the condition of her husband Edge and was immediately interrupted by Randall Keith Orton. Out he comes. He tried for a hug. He went for a handshake. She said, "You think I would take a hug or a handshake from you? What you did to my husband?" Called him a son of a bitch. And Orton finally took the mic and he explained his actions and he told a story about his father, Cowboy Bob Orton, taking him backstage to a WWF show in St. Louis in 1999. I'm a nerd, so of course I had to look it up to see if I can actually figure out which show was it. WWE came to St. Louis that year four times, one of which was actually the night after Owen Hart died, for that Owen Hart tribute episode of Monday Night Raw. It wasn't that. It could not have been that night. Orton, if you remember in his promo here, Orton said, "I was backstage with my dad. I saw all the big stars like Austin and Triple H and Mick Foley and Davey Boy Smith." Well, the Bulldog returned to the company that year in September, which means it had to have been the October 24th show at the Kiel Center. This is assuming that the story is even true and he didn't just make this up for a promo. I'm assuming it's true. Edge was on that show that night, and so was Davey Boy. It had to be that one. And he said that the one guy who went up to his dad to tell him how much he respected him and how he was one of his, you know, you're one of the best bad guys ever in the business, was Edge. And Edge looked at Randy and told him, hey, maybe one day we'll share the ring together. And he never forgot that. He used to be very insecure, and Edge gave him confidence, and they fought against each other. They teamed up together as partners. He made some bad life choices. He buried himself, and Edge was the one to pull him out of that hole. Edge saved his life. He says, Edge is the reason that I can be a great father to my own kids today. So when he saw Edge come back at the Royal Rumble, he knew that he couldn't come back for just one match. He's a junkie. He feeds off the crowd. He knew that he would come back for more, and he did not want to see his friend wind up in a wheelchair and not be able to be a father to his little girls. So he did what he did to save Edge because he loves him, because he loves Beth, he loves their daughters. And then he said, it wasn't my fault what happened, it's your fault. He put the blame on Beth, called her an enabler. You enabled your husband. Some people in the crowd at this point were cheering this promo, which I'm sure was not the intended effect. But there were a lot of people in the crowd cheering. Not everybody, but enough of them to notice. Orton said he realized that he, himself, loved Beth's kids more than she and Edge did, and with that, Beth slapped him across the face. Orton called her a bitch under his breath. And that's when Beth kicked him in the gut, and Orton dropped her with an RKO. Now note that they had her kick him first, before he delivered the RKO, as a way for him, I guess, to argue self-defense. Fans chanted one more time, because we can't have serious wrestling angles anymore, I guess. They did the same thing with Matt Hardy a few weeks ago. Remember that? When Orton was killing this guy, they fans chanted one more time. This is why we can't have nice things. They cut to the crowd, they wouldn't show the ring, they wanted to really make this out to, you know, add to the sense of realism here. They cut to the announcers were acting all solemn, and of course, they then cut to three replays of this guy laying this woman out, so I mean, how heinous could it really be? They showed fucking three replays to us. But a bunch of wrestlers ran down to help Beth, including her old tag team partner Natty, who she is rumored to be tagging with possibly at WrestleMania against the Kabuki Warriors. This was a great angle. Predictable, sure. You know, but I said last week, this ends one of two ways. Either Orton RKOs her, which he did, and gets massive heat, which he really didn't. He actually got cheered by a lot. He got some heat, but he got cheered by a lot more people than I thought. Or the babyfaces are not dumb for a change. Edge has to know that Orton might go after his wife, and so when he does, Edge pops out and attacks Orton. He's all healed up. They have to break it up. And they chose to go with the former option. And the fans instead chanted one more time, which does not speak very well to the fans in, where were they again? Brooklyn. Of course they were in Brooklyn. Why am I not surprised? I've only lived here my entire life. So this was a great segment. Now, the other way that they could have gone with Orton's explanation, instead of overcomplicating it with the whole, I crippled him before he could cripple himself, which really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It is a bit of a reach for an explanation, but at least they gave us one. But I think there's an alternative way they could have gone with this, and it's very simple. Randy Orton was really happy to see Edge back in the Royal Rumble match, his old partner, his old friend, until Edge eliminated him. No mention of the fact that Edge eliminated Randy Orton from the Royal Rumble. You want to make the Rumble feel special? He was really happy to see Edge back until Edge dumped him out of the ring. Edge took away his chance to go to the main event of WrestleMania. In one night, Edge not only stole his chance to win the championship, but he stole the spotlight from him after his little 9-year vacation. No phone calls, no text messages, no visits. You never even bothered to introduce me to your two little girls. I've never even met your kids before. I thought we were brothers. 9 years go by, I don't hear from you. And then you show up like you never left the place and you eliminate me from the Royal Rumble? I had to put you down, Edge. I had to dim your hopes of ever coming back again because you abandoned me. You abandoned this company. And I'll be damned if I'm going to let you come in and take my spot. And you can still run the angle here where he gives Beth an RKO. That story could have worked too. You know? They're not ones for the element of surprise either, because WWE has already announced that Edge is going to be returning on Raw tomorrow night to address what Randy Orton did to him and his wife. The following Monday is 316, and Stone Cold Steve Austin is coming back to Raw to celebrate 316 Day. Then after the show, WWE Network is airing a new Broken Skull Sessions with Austin interviewing Bret the Hitman Hart, which, there you go, that's why Austin's going to be there. He's going to be plugging his interview. They taped the interview back in January. This will be the first time that Austin interviews Bret on the network. He's had Bret on his podcast before, but never in studio on the network. And as a huge Bret mark, by my own admission, I'm looking forward to this episode because Bret in these types of situations does not hold back. So there's no filter. And I think what you hear is going to be his honest-to-God interpretation of how he views things. And if that means that he has to shit on WWE, I suspect that we will probably see Bret Hart shitting on WWE on some things. Although they've had 2 months to edit the interview. So I guess if there's something in there that they really don't like, they could have edited it. Hopefully they don't do that, I hope. But I am looking forward to that interview. SmackDown was in Buffalo this week. And I don't really have a lot else to say that I didn't say earlier about some of the stuff that happened on SmackDown. There was no Roman Reigns. There was no Bill Goldberg. I think the show did its second lowest rating of the year, I believe. Hell of a draw that Goldberg is. And don't tell me, oh, Goldberg wasn't on the show. Nobody knew that. Nobody knew that Goldberg wasn't going to be there. You could also say no John Cena. But yeah, hell of a draw that Goldberg is so far. Bray's explanation of the Firefly Funhouse, that really was the big takeaway from the show this week. They went down the road I figured they would with this, which is 6 years ago, you and I wrestled at WrestleMania 30, John, you beat me. They showed highlights from the match and John Cena pinning Bray Wyatt. And the story is that that is what set Bray on this path of just sort of losing his mind. And the Firefly Funhouse would not exist were it not for John Cena. You know, beating Bray all the way back then, 6 years ago. And it's been this slow descent for him into madness ever since. It's the right story to go with since they don't have number 17, which should have been the story. It should have been about the championship. And you could still work this in. That's why I was arguing the whole number 17 thing, you know, last week or the week before, because now, you know, not only is the championship on the line, you've got John Cena threatening to set this all-time record of title reigns here in this company. But Bray's got a bone to pick with him as well, and you can tell this exact same story. So they're doing that, but just with no championship at stake, which I think is a mistake. But the NWO stuff, I talked about that earlier. I thought Waltman physically looked good. The other guys, I mean, for God's sakes, it's like, you know, especially Hall. It is weird when you see these guys and they're in the ring, the legends, and they're still trying to act all cool. And the current generation, and I get their heel. Sammy's a heel and Shinsuke's a heel and Cesaro's a heel. And they have to back down and cower from these guys. It's I don't know. It's sad. It's just sad to watch. Coming off a pay-per-view, AEW Dynamite beat NXT again this week by a healthy margin in the ratings. Nearly 200,000 viewers separated the two shows. 906,000 overnight viewers for AEW to NXT 718,000. And this is an NXT show that promoted two steel cage matches. And the gap actually widened. It didn't narrow. It widened in AEW's favor this week. AEW cracked the top five on cable, beat out an NBA game, so TNT should be very happy. I thought Dynamite was another very good show this week. Not as strong as the last 2 weeks, but a very good show. I thought it was very clever, nice little clever tease to have Chris Jericho say that he would leave for 60 days if Jon Moxley would still be standing at the end of the night. You know, figuring people would assume, oh, he must be going back on tour with Fozzy. He must be leaving. And then what happens? Jericho wins. And Moxley is left laying. Jericho's not back on tour with Fozzy until mid-April. So he's not going anywhere so soon. And watching the end of the show back, the group powerbomb to Moxley through the table, off the stage. I didn't, when I was answering someone's phone call during the Dynamite stream on YouTube Wednesday night. And I said, I don't think it necessarily was a play off the Shield. I think it was just, you know, we've seen them do power bombs off the stage to people before. You know, there's no link necessarily to the Shield or to WWE. Well, I watched the ending back, and I missed the shot of all the Inner Circle members sort of mimicking the old Shield fist bump, only with the middle fingers. So yes, that definitely was a play off the Shield. I missed that. Had I seen that, it would have been obvious that yes, it was a play off the Shield. Darby Allin, he may have been injured. It's hard to know whether it's a work. Is it legit? He may have been injured in the main event on that dive through the ropes. Brutal spot where he got back elbowed by Jericho on the way through the ropes. That's the Judas effect. And he connected just perfectly, right on the dot. Elbowed this guy right in the head, right in the face. And Darby tweeted a photo later from the hospital. Again, it could just be a work that builds to him having to partner up with Jon Moxley against the Inner Circle in that Blood and Guts match on March 25th. We are going to get the rules for Blood and Guts on Dynamite this week. I have to assume that this is building to Jericho, Hager, Sammy, Santana, and Ortiz in the double ring cage against Moxley, Darby, who else? Now, this is me assuming it's a 5-on-5, like War Games would be, that it's a 5-on-5 match. It could be 4-on-4. It could be totally different rules altogether. Just because it's two rings in one cage doesn't mean it's going to be the same exact rules of War Games. They may put their own spin on this. But if it is following the same format, who would the other three partners be? I guess maybe Dustin. You know, Dustin can be Hangman and Omega. Kenny Omega's out for probably another 2 weeks. He's got a broken finger. So if he's not cleared for if he's cleared in two weeks, he would be back in time for that show on the 25th. So it could be Hangman and Omega. Maybe with Omega and Moxley being unwilling partners. Yeah. Who knows? We'll see. But Omega was not on the show this week because of the broken finger. Nick Jackson, he is at home with his wife, expecting their third young buck. On the way, I guess, any day now. And the last thing I had to mention here, actually two things. Jake the Snake Roberts. Unlike a lot of the other legends that we've seen on TV recently, who are beating some of the younger talents and winning championships, thankfully they had enough sense not to put Jake in the ring as a in-ring performer. But he did come out to do what he does best, which is cut a promo, because there's very few people in this business, probably ever, who were as good on the microphone, even still to this day, as Jake the Snake Roberts. I don't want to say he's a number one. I'd have to think about that. But he's up there. He's one of the very best of all time. And he's looking good. You know, I know he's still doing the one-man show. I saw him on the Jericho Cruise. He seems to be doing well. He's got his shit together. I like seeing that. Hopefully it stays that way. But that was really what was holding him back for so long, I'm sure, from WWE and other promotions bringing him in. You know, can he be trusted? Is he going to fall off the wagon? Is he going to be a liability for our company? He's a guy, he's a very creative guy. I'm sure Jake would be a great asset. A healthy, sober Jake the Snake Roberts could be a great asset, and maybe now will be for AEW. I hope so. But he came out, interrupted Cody during Cody's promo. And you can go back, I recap the whole segment on my Dynamite stream. I'm not going to recap all the dialogue and everything, but he was teasing a new client that he was bringing in to go after Cody. And my first thought, and a lot of you probably felt the same way, Brody Lee, Luke Harper, his contract, he's going to be free and clear very soon, very shortly, as in within a week or two. He'll be free from the shackles of his contract with WWE and free to go to AEW or anywhere that he pleases. Imagine Brody Lee being brought in as Jake the Snake's client. Imagine Jake the Snake managing Luke Harper. What about Lance Archer? Lance Archer was supposed to be on the show this week. Was nowhere to be seen. There was a change in creative plans. He wasn't even there. I didn't even notice until the show was over. I must have enjoyed the show because I didn't even realize Archer wasn't there until the show was over. And I went on the stream. I said, wait a minute. There's no Lance Archer. So could it be him? It could be. I don't know that Archer needs Jake, though. I really don't. I think Harper, especially on promos, We already know he can't use a southern accent, right? We already know that. But I think he's more of a wild card when it comes to promos. Archer, I don't know that he needs Jake. Not that he wouldn't benefit from him and that they wouldn't make an interesting combo. I don't know that it's necessarily Archer. But it could be. I think he's definitely got to be a candidate that's in the running. But I like the idea of Jake coming in even just selectively. Like what they do with Tully Blanchard. Tully Blanchard, if anything, is way underutilized for the role that they have him with Sean Spears. We see more of Arn Anderson on TV with Cody. I like the way that they're using these legends. They're using them as managers. And the art of the manager became such a lost art in wrestling. And I grew up with it. And there are people older than me who were wrestling fans probably in the 70s and the 80s. You remember all those great managers from back in the day and how useful they could be. And then there was this period of time in WWE where they just basically did away with them. They'd have a few people, you know, like female valets and stuff, but the art of the manager was all but dead. And it's kind of nice to see it making a comeback now, because I really think that could be a very helpful tool for a lot of these guys on the roster, whether they're just there to just be a mouthpiece or just be part of their act and try to help them get over in some way. I don't mind them using legends to help get other people over. What I resent is when there's too many legends being used for the opposite reason. That's where I have a problem. You know, you want to bring the NWO out on TV this week on SmackDown like they did, they're going to go into the Hall of Fame. Okay, Alexa Bliss is going to talk to them and interview them in the ring about their Hall of Fame induction. And what did the NWO do on TV on Friday night? Did they help get anybody over? No. They were mocking Goldberg. They were openly mocking the Universal Champion because they got one over on him 20 years ago at Starrcade. Then the heels have to back down and cower from Scott Hall, who could barely move. I mean, come on. There are ways to do it, and there are ways not to do it. That's my beef. That's my issue with that. I don't hate the legends. I like seeing the legends, but use them smartly. Don't use them at the expense of your roster. But it's faction warfare in AEW. Look at the list of factions and trios that they have in this company right now. The Inner Circle, the Elite, Jurassic Express. Now we have the Death Triangle with Pac and the Lucha Bros. Best Friends and Orange Cassidy. Butcher, Blade, Bunny. Actually, Butcher, Blade, and MJF have been a trio of late. The Dark Order, SCU. Am I missing any? I might be missing more. That's a lot of groups. It's almost like gang rules in WWE back in 97. Only I'm not completely bored by some of these factions like I was with the Bariquas and DOA. Ah, yes, the days of DOA. Skull and 8-Ball and Chains. And Crush. How exciting. It's no wonder I am not a fan of the Sons of Anarchy or the Forgotten Sons on NXT. But you see all of these factions and, you know, it makes me wonder, maybe they are going to introduce a Trios title very soon. If you have enough trios, if you have enough combinations, you can do a trios title. But I think the more urgent thing would be to introduce a mid-card singles title for the men. I think that should be the priority more than anything else. NXT. What's better than one cage match? Two cage matches, which is what we got on this week's NXT. A very heel-heavy show. All of the heels won all 5 matches on the show this week, although the babyface, you know, Velveteen Dream at the end, he did voluntarily sacrifice the win in the main event as part of a bigger plan that he had. He did stand tall to end the night, so that was nice. We had Dakota Kai in a cage against Tegan Nox. Kai had Raquel Gonzalez outside the cage in her corner. I thought it was good. I thought some of the stalling by Tegan Nox in her attempts to flee the cage were comical. There was a choke slam off the ropes by Lady Kane folding up Kai. People call Tegan Nox Lady Kane because she's a huge Kane mark. Nox, she climbed up to the top of the cage. At one point, she took out Dakota Kai with a high crossbody. Gonzalez was holding the door shut, so Tegan couldn't escape. Kai accidentally kicks the door back in Raquel's face. Shiniest wizard by Tegan Nox only gets her a 2 count. We get to the finish of this cage match. I thought the finish was clever. I liked the finish. Tegan Nox was climbing out. She was climbing over the cage on the side of the ring where the door was. Gonzalez swings the door open and presses it up against Tegan's body. She has trapped her, so she cannot climb down. And that allowed Dakota Kai time to scurry out the door and win the match. So I give them points for the clever finish. But as with some of the ladder matches that we often see, the stalling by the babyfaces, I just feel like there's a way that it could be done that doesn't make the babyface look like a fool. Tegan looked like a fool in certain parts of this match. And I understand, you know, sometimes it's not even their fault. Your opponent is too slow. You're waiting for them to come over and climb and pull you down. And just like in a ladder match, you got to stall for time. But don't just stand there, you know, like, don't move like a fucking armadillo. You know, slip off a little, my knee, or, you know, something. It just makes them look so silly sometimes. We've now had a street fight between these two and a steel cage match, both of which Dakota Kai won. So I'm not sure what the next stipulation is going to be. You know, it may be a match between Tegan and Raquel Gonzalez. But the blow-off to this, they've already burned through two big stipulations. Maybe an Iron Woman match? I'm still advocating for my idea for Sasha and Bayley's Iron Man match many years ago. Trademarks be damned. They should have called it an Iron Maiden match. I don't care what anybody says. I'm going to die on that hill. Should have been an Iron Maiden match. We had a Finn Balor video promising that Walter is not going to like his reaction to what Fabian Aichner and Marcel Bartel did to him. He tells Walter that he'll be seeing him sooner than he thinks. And in fact, he did appear at the NXT UK tapings. I'm not going to say what he did, but he did appear at the tapings this week. That match is going to kick all kinds of ass. Finn Balor and Walter is going to be great. They had a cool video feature showing Rhea Ripley walking around Raymond James Stadium in Tampa, the site of WrestleMania, hopefully. Talking about what Charlotte's dad always said, you know, to be the man, you gotta beat the man, and at WrestleMania, to be the best, I've gotta beat the best. And that's exactly what I'm gonna do. It would be stunning to me if all of the younger talent, or the current roster talent, in some of these key matches at WrestleMania this year, if they all went over on the legends and the established stars. So you have to think that out of Roman Reigns against Bill Goldberg, John Cena against The Fiend, Brock Lesnar against Drew McIntyre, Undertaker if he goes one-on-one with AJ Styles, and Charlotte against Rhea, you would have to think at least one of the new stars or current roster stars are going to lose. I'd be stunned if they all won in a clean sweep. And I think the likeliest of all those matches I just mentioned is probably Undertaker over AJ Styles. Because AJ is going to be... They probably know, look, AJ is going to be fine. I mean, losing to The Undertaker is hardly going to be a death blow for AJ Styles. The question really is, should AJ Styles be losing to an Undertaker who can barely move when he's in the ring in a singles match? Tag team match, you can hide a lot of that. In a singles match, I mean, it's very iffy what kind of performance we're going to get out of The Undertaker. You know, Charlotte going over on Rhea would be a bad move. You know, her one match in NXT against Bianca didn't move the numbers much. So if their idea is, well, we got to put Charlotte on NXT, it'll boost the ratings. Well, that wasn't bore out by the numbers when she was on TV facing Bianca Belair. They still lost. And I don't think the numbers really went up even that much. So what value really is there having Charlotte take the NXT championship and stifle Rhea's big push unless they're going to move her on up to Raw or SmackDown? You know, Goldberg, he's not beating Roman. That leaves Brock and Drew and Cena against The Fiend. I think conventional wisdom goes out the window here. I expect Drew to win, but we've seen Brock retain before WrestleMania. In fact, he's retained over Roman Reigns, and Roman Reigns was Vince's pet project. And he beat him clean. You know, Cena and The Fiend, it should be The Fiend getting his Mania win back and getting back to his winning ways. And I think John Cena would be happy to do business. I really think that he would be fine with doing business, but it's not his call. I don't get the sense, and I'm not backstage, I don't know the guy personally, but I get the sense that with you know, John Cena over the years, how much pushback do you think he's really given to Vince McMahon? You know, we hear stories about top stars. Oh, I don't like this. You know, fold it up, crumple it up, throw it in the garbage. If it's a promo or something, something they want them to say. Or if there's some other idea they don't agree with. Where's Vince? I got to go talk to Vince. I got to go, you know, or getting in a shouting match with Vince McMahon. I can't say that we've really heard stories like that at all about John Cena over the years. So how much pushback do you really think over the years John Cena has given Vince McMahon? Not just some of the wins where he probably should not have won, but like the corny promos for so long. How do you not push back on some of that and say, no, this is a bad idea, unless he did and he was just overruled? But let's say, hypothetically, it's the day of WrestleMania. Vince McMahon tells John Cena, hey, you're beating The Fiend. You're the bigger star than he is. You're a bigger star. We only have you back for one match. We want to have a feel-good moment at WrestleMania. You go up. Wyatt goes down. What would Cena do? What would he say? I wonder. Would he fight it? I would hope that he would. I wish some of these other top names and some of these older guys who come in for stuff like this, I wish that sometimes they would have the guts to do the same thing when they know that it's the right thing to do for business, that it's right for the future. But I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know what he would do. Chelsea Green qualified for the women's ladder match at TakeOver Tampa. There is going to be a women's ladder match for the right to challenge the NXT Women's Champion after WrestleMania, whether it be Charlotte or whether it be Rhea Ripley. Chelsea Green won with the unprettier, no botch this time, or at least that's how Shotzi took the move, Shotzi Blackheart. She took the unprettier the correct way, not the reverse way that I guess Chelsea would sometimes hit it in Impact. I guess it was by design. To me, it just looks like a botch. That's not the way you do that move. This was the unprettier, which she is now calling the I'm prettier. So she has taken the move as her own. We got more teases for a new star coming in. Shots of the sands of an hourglass running out. Shots of a clock. I could have sworn I saw a mention of TikTok in there somewhere, which of course, I mean, that's Killer Cross. If it's TikTok, then that's exactly who it's for. I thought the glitches on SmackDown could be for Killer Cross until somebody pointed out that the circles are identical to the circle on Mustafa Ali's glove, that light-up glove that he has. So that could very well be for Mustafa Ali's pending return, and if it's not, then where the fuck is he? You talk about wasted talent. I'm not saying put the belt on him, but why isn't he on the TV show? This looks to be for Killer Cross. You know, maybe they're saving his debut for TakeOver in Tampa. I hope it's not just him sitting in the crowd, because to me that's lame at this point. He needs to make an impact. Keith Lee was interrupted by Cameron Grimes, who got mega heat because people just really don't like him. They find him very annoying. They're going to have a match this week on TV for the North American title. Bobby Fish and Kyle O'Reilly beat Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch. After the match, Fish called Matt Riddle and Pete Dunne the loser weights, which brought out the broser weights. And they were down to give Undisputed Era a rematch if they wanted one for the tag team titles until the Grizzled Young Veterans jumped them from behind, the Grizzled Young Vets from NXT UK. And next week on the NXT episode, which is going to be live this Wednesday from the Performance Center, a special episode of NXT, Matt Riddle and Pete Dunne will defend their titles against Fish and O'Reilly. My guess is we probably get a non-finish. And, you know, grizzled young veterans run in and we end up with a three-way dance in Tampa. Otherwise, really, if you think about it, if they just lose here, Fish and O'Reilly have no match at the next TakeOver show. And there is a real lack of tag teams. You know, for as strong as that women's division is, I think still is in NXT, the tag team division is going the other way. It's the polar opposite at this point. They don't have very many teams or very many strong teams in NXT. When you get past the Broserweights, which is a makeshift team, and you get past Undisputed Era, I mean, they've had to now import teams from the UK. Grizzled Young Veterans are not an NXT team. They're an NXT UK team. They have to import another team because they don't have anybody else. Whether they're the Forgotten Sons. Wendell, one of the mods in our Facebook group, he made this point. I agree. On this point, I agree. Their tag team division has really taken a hit. And they got a big problem when it comes to tag teams. So I can't imagine they have a tag team championship match at TakeOver that doesn't include, you know, the UE, just because who else is there? Austin Theory, he's been, you know, getting a lot of TV time lately. He beat Isaiah Swerve Scott in a good match. He's only 22, but they've got him earmarked for big things, clearly. I thought the sit-down interview with the PC with Mauro Ranallo and Johnny Gargano was really good, the way he played off Mauro and how, you know, I was the only person there who attended the premiere of your documentary when it came out. And then he talked about Mauro saying, why Johnny, why? Mauro called him Johnny Turncoat on TV after he turned on Tommaso Ciampa. And this very much upset Johnny Gargano. And Mauro, he was stammering. He was trying to explain himself. Gargano was getting all up in his grill. He said, Mauro hasn't reached out to me since Portland. I haven't heard from you. Yet when Tommaso Ciampa returns, it's, oh, daddy's home. Mauro says, things are getting very uncomfortable. I'm going to leave. And he walks off. And Gargano looks into the camera to address Tommaso Ciampa, and he says, you know why. And now they're going to do things the Johnny Gargano way. He came off unhinged here. The only question is, what is the stipulation going to be for their match in Tampa? Do they do Hell in a Cell? I floated that as a possibility last week. First ever Hell in a Cell match in NXT. Or are they going to try to get another 2 to 3 takeover matches out of this feud, and they're not going to blow it off in Tampa? This could go on for another 6 months. I don't know what they're going to do. Roderick Strong against the Velveteen Dream, our second steel cage match of the night. That was the main event. I thought it was a very good match with a finish that I liked. I liked the finish in both cage matches on this show. Undisputed Era ran down. They were trying to prevent the Dream from escaping the cage. Adam Cole ended up inside the cage. The cage is supposed to be there. It defeats the entire purpose of even doing a cage match, but whatever. What I liked is that when Dream saw that Adam Cole was inside, he looked over at Roddy, he looked over at Cole, he's kind of surveying the situation. He grabs Roddy, and he tossed him out the door, which gave Roddy the win. He sacrificed the win to get his hands on Adam Cole. He threw Roddy out, he closed the door, he padlocked it shut. He gladly took the loss here in this meaningless match that didn't mean anything to him to get his hands on the NXT champion. And he's beating up Adam Cole. The UE members are trying to climb in. They're trying to get inside the cage, and they keep getting knocked down. Dream Valley Driver onto a chair. Dream picks up the NXT title, and he poses with it on top of the cage to close out the show. So we now have our main event for Tampa. Got to be Dream winning the championship, I would think. You know, that back injury that he suffered really did stall his momentum. You know, Adam Cole and Rhea Ripley both had an incredible November. Those two people had probably, hands down, the best single month in either of their careers. And Adam Cole's been doing this a lot longer than Rhea Ripley has, but they had the best month of their careers in the month of November, starting from that, you know, post-Saudi Arabia SmackDown when everybody was stranded. And we had the NXT show, the NXT episode of SmackDown. And Adam Cole had that great match and that big win over Daniel Bryan on TV. And the month for him only got better. The month for Rhea Ripley only got better. And, you know, meanwhile, Velveteen Dream missed out on all of that. He missed out on all the hype heading into Survivor Series. He wasn't part of any of it. Adam Cole has had the championship long enough. He's going to break the all-time record in 2 weeks. And then he can drop it to Dream in Tampa. If Vince McMahon is possibly ready to give up on Shayna Baszler, as these, there was that one report this week that suggested he might well be on the cusp of giving up on this woman after one match that he didn't like on TV. If that's the case, then the Velveteen Dream needs to get down on his knees and pray that Based H anoints him the champion at TakeOver. I would say pay him off with a bribe, but Triple H married a McMahon. He doesn't need the money. So find another way. But he better hope that they belt him on that show and don't send him to Raw or SmackDown. And here I was hoping that he would be the one to get the match with John Cena at WrestleMania, with John Cena putting him over. What a fool I was for even thinking that. NWA Power this week. We have a new NWA television champion. His name is Zicky Dice. The reign of Ricky Starks has come to an end. There was a botched tornado DDT attempt by Starks, who hit Dice with a Michinoku driver instead for a near fall. Zicky hit his shake, rattle, and roll neckbreaker. Starks got his foot under the bottom rope. Dice grabbed his loaded fanny pack, brings it out with him for every match. I assume it's loaded, otherwise, I mean, for God's sakes, it's a fanny pack. But referee took it away from him. Starks went for the stroke. Dice backdropped out of it, sat down, hooked the legs forward, and got the win. Now, I know some people don't like Zicky Dice, but I look at him and I think to myself, he's a character, he's a total throwback to an old-school, annoying, slimy wrestling heel. You feel like you want to take 5 showers after coming in contact with the guy, and I mean that as a compliment. I mean that in the nicest way possible. He's an interesting guy. You know, he trained with Seth Rollins at Rollins' Black and Brave School. Rollins only knew him from his music, because besides wrestling, Zicky has his own band called Heart to Heart, for those who don't know. That's how Rollins came to befriend him. And then one day he texted Rollins and said, look, I want you to train me. So he went to his school, and that's where he learned the ropes. I told you guys previously, you know, he also works with adults with developmental disabilities when he's not wrestling or doing his music. He just seems like a decent human being. And I like seeing good things happen to good people. So as much as I am supposed to dislike him on television, I find myself rooting for him to succeed. Sean Mooney gave us a Crockett Cup update with highlights from the press conference at the Gateway Center. We got comments from Nick Aldis and Marty Scurll. April 19th is the date. Aldis just passed 500 days this week as the NWA World's Heavyweight Champion. There was a weird segment with the question mark sitting on a couch next to a ventriloquist with a dummy that they called Little Question, who said that he was doing research on Mongrovian Wikipedia about the Mongrovian flag, and has an ostrich on one side of it and an anteater on the other. It was basically an ad for Mongrovian flags that are supposedly on sale on the NWA shop website, although they spelled the URL wrong on the screen. They left the CE out at the end of nationalwrestlingalliance.com. When I went to their shop website, though, I saw no Mongrovian flags. So this may have just been a gag, but I'm sure there are people who would be willing to buy those flags if they actually were selling them. I tried to buy an NWA Gold Globe logo t-shirt on their website, but they're sold out in every size, which I guess is good, but they need to restock. I gotta get my NWA shirt. Shooter Stevens wants to win NWA Tag Team Gold with the question mark. He called out the Rock and Roll Express. He wants a match with them, and he wants them to, wink wink, do business. He basically wants them to take a dive. If they do business for him, he promises to put them in his next movie. And Ricky Morton promised to do business, but I don't think it's the kind of business that Stevens was hoping for. Caleb Conley and C.W. Anderson beat the Dawsons in a last chance match, with the losers not having their contracts renewed by the NWA. And the winners would earn contracts to stay. This was Tornado Rules. Anderson hit a nice Arn Anderson spinebuster, and Conley hit a marrow salt off the top, same moonsault that Lacey Evans now does, where she hops up to the top rope and then hits a very impressive moonsault. He hit that for the win. So Caleb Conley keeps his NWA contract. C.W. Anderson earns himself an NWA contract. And the Dawsons, supposedly, are gone. They are up Dawson's Creek. Joe Galli interviewed Mae Valentine and the one-armed man Sal Rinaro, her BFF, as he has been recovering from a broken arm. He has somehow become best friends with this woman. They talked about her vlog and her new lingerie line, which Sal is helping her out with. I'll bet he is. I'll bet he is. Sal says he's about a month away from his return to the ring, and at first, you know, he considered his injury a bad break. But as it turned out, it was a lucky break. She starts filming for her blog. All of a sudden, her boyfriend, cuckboy Royce Isaacs, comes walking out. You can't let this go on. You are allowing this weird man to work with your girlfriend on her lingerie line. So he threatens to break Sal's other arm, which he should have done. May talked him out of it. She was very upset with Royce after this whole situation. He's the jealous boyfriend. I think in this case he has a right to be. I believe he is justified. This is wrestling. He knows exactly what happens when you let your wife or your girlfriend pal around with another man, work an angle with another man. He's no dummy. As Randy Savage once told Lance Storm, I did an angle with my wife once, and I ain't got no wife no more. It's not as good as Bruce Pritchard or Dan Soder's impersonation of Randy Savage, but I did dress up as Randy Savage Halloween 2 years ago. I did that voice the entire night. My throat was bleeding. How that guy went through his whole life with that voice, I'll never know. Coincidentally, Lance Storm did say that he never did an angle with his wife after that, and he's been married for 25 years. So, there you go. Main event was Eli Drake and James Storm retaining their NWA tag team titles over the Bouncers, Beer City Bruiser Brian Malonis from Ring of Honor. The Pope was in the corner of the Bouncers. Eddie Kingston was ringside keeping an eye on the Pope. Storm hit a sunset flip powerbomb to Malonis off the top rope. Brian Malonis is a big man, every bit of 400 pounds. And Drake and Storm picked him up. Barely got him up, but they got him up. All 400 pounds of him, and they slammed him. Last call super kick to the Bruiser, followed by the jumping elbow by Eli Drake wins it. Kingston got in the ring. He challenged Pope to come on inside, and he started to take his vest off, and Pope took his sunglasses off, and he was threatening like he was going to come in, but then he thought better of it, and he walked off with the Bouncers. Thought it was a good show this week. No great promos to speak of, which usually is the strong point of the show, but they changed the TV title, and I thought the main event was fun. And now some scheduling notes. I don't believe there is another new episode of Power until St. Patrick's Day. This Tuesday, they're running a double episode of The Circle Squared, episodes 2 and 3, with new talents fighting for a contract. The following Tuesday, they're calling it Superpower. I guess that's kind of like their version of Raw and SmackDown Super Show. And they've got a bunch of big matches. Tim Storm is going to take on Jax Dane, the man that he beat 4 years ago to win the NWA Championship. And if Storm wins, he gets 5 minutes alone with Danny Deals, the man who has been impersonating Mama Storm. Aaron Stevens in the question mark. They go up against the Rock and Roll Express. Nick Aldis and Tom Latimer against Marty Scurll and Brody King of Villain Enterprises. We're going to find out Thunder Rosa's opponent for the women's title at the Crockett Cup. And Camille will not only make her in-ring Power debut, but she will speak for the first time. For those of you who haven't seen her speak on her Instagram. Not to kill kayfabe, but if you want to hear her speak on TV for the first time, you'll have that chance in 2 weeks. And then starting March 24th, all the way through to the Crockett Cup on April 19th, they're going to be airing special programming, including the debut of Power Surge, which is a long-form discussion-based series, the Crockett Cup selection show, and the return of the 10 Pounds of Gold series, which I thought was great before. But that kind of makes it sound like we're not going to have any regular Power episodes for those 3 weeks leading up to the Crockett Cup. We have time for one mailbag question. I wanted to feature more, but don't have a lot of time. And this is something I wanted to make sure that I got into. I was going to cover it earlier, but I figured I'll do it here in the mailbag because I got a question from all the way from India. Utkarsh from India. Chris Jericho is my favorite wrestler. And seeing as how he won Wrestler of the Year in the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Awards, I think he is one of the top 10 wrestlers of all time in terms of mic and ring work. What do you think about the Observer Awards, and do you think Jericho deserves a place in the top 10 greatest of all time? Well, again, this is as good of a place as any to just give my quick thoughts on the Observer Awards. I did see them. When I got this question, I figured I'd talk about it here. I'll get to your Jericho question, but first, for those who missed it, for those who care, these were the winners from the key categories. And remember, Dave Meltzer does not assign awards to people. These categories were voted on by the readers of The Observer. And part of that readership are wrestlers and people who are in the business. So it's not just fans. This is voted on by them, not by Dave. Wrestler of the Year for 2019 was Chris Jericho. He edged out Okada by a few hundred votes, and Will Ospreay, he came in third. Ospreay was my Wrestler of the Year pick for 2019. Just the quality of the matches that he had with Tanahashi and Okada and Kota Ibushi, Shingo Takagi, Lance Archer. I mean, the list goes on. It was incredible. He put together an incredible body of work in 2019. I will not argue, though, with Jericho. Jericho is, you can have Jericho as your choice for number one. That's fine. I think that that's makes sense. You know, Jericho's a worthy choice. Adam Cole was the only WWE affiliated name on the list at number five. Jon Moxley, he spent his first few months of the year with WWE, but, you know, he was on the list. I think he came in number nine. I didn't jot down his spot, but I wouldn't really count him as a WWE guy last year. Lucha Bros won for Tag Team of the Year. New Japan won for Promotion of the Year, followed by AEW at number two and WWE at number three. Dynamite wins for Best Weekly Wrestling TV Show, followed by NXT at number two, and NWA Power at number three. No Raw or SmackDown anywhere to be found in the top 10. And I say good, because even though we're seeing improvements now on Monday Night Raw, there's signs of life, there's signs of improvement so far this year. Monday Night Raw was largely a shit show in 2019. So, good. Does not belong in the top 10. Match of the Year was Will Ospreay against Shingo Takagi in the Best of the Super Juniors Finals. That was my Match of the Year as well. Tanahashi Omega from Wrestle Kingdom was number two, and Cody versus Dustin from Double or Nothing came in number three. Johnny Gargano and Adam Cole from TakeOver Brooklyn was number five. Walter against Tyler Bate from TakeOver Cardiff was number eight. I had those at number two and number three, respectively, on my list. Not a single WWE main roster match made the top 10. I think I had two on mine. Daniel Bryan and Kofi Kingston from WrestleMania 35 and the Men's Elimination Chamber match for the WWE Championship. King Corbin wins for Most Overrated by an overwhelming margin. Almost 600 votes separated King Corbin at number one from the Monday Night Messiah in the number two spot. Bray Wyatt was number three for Most Overrated. Most Underrated winner was Chad Gable. And I hope Johnny Gargano understands the fate that awaits him when and if he ever hits the Raw or SmackDown roster. He'll also get the Shorty G name, so Vince McMahon can put them together as a tag team. He can call them Shorty G's. Jungle Boy wins for Rookie of the Year. Kevin Kelly wins for Best TV Announcer. Well deserved. With Excalibur at number two and Tony Schiavone at number three. Corey Graves, Michael Cole, and Beth Phoenix take the number one, number two, and number three spots for Worst TV Announcer. This was a list that also included Josh Matthews and Alex Marvez. So I disagree strongly with those rankings. And I know how annoying Cole can be. I know how annoying Corey Graves can be. Beth Phoenix isn't great, but she's learning. You cannot put them at number one, number two, and number three on a list that has Josh Matthews and Alex Marvez. You can't do that. Most disgusting promotional tactic goes to WWE, continuing to do business in Saudi Arabia, second straight year. Last year, they won the award for the doing business with them after the Khashoggi murder. Monday Night Raw won for Worst TV Show, well-deserved. Worst match of the year was The Fiend against The Messiah at Hell in a Cell. Number two was Goldberg against The Undertaker at Sweet Saudi Money. I agree with that. I know some people disagreed. They said, how could Goldberg, Undertaker not be number one? I agree with it. The reason being, Undertaker and Goldberg was not a match that mattered. There was no title on the line. There was nothing at stake. There was no real value or importance to it other than just taking two big names and putting them in a match together. And it was shorter. The Goldberg, Undertaker was probably 6, 7, 8 minutes of shit. Whereas Fiend and the Messiah was 18 minutes of shit. I'll take 8 minutes of shit over 18 minutes of shit. Best gimmick was The Fiend, Bray Wyatt. Worst gimmick was Shorty G, but interestingly, The Fiend was number three. So you gotta love The Fiend winning for best gimmick, but coming in the top three for worst gimmick. And finally, WWE wins for worst promotion of the year. Ring of Honor was number two, and Impact Wrestling was number three. There was a lot to hate about WWE last year. A lot to like, but a lot to hate. But Ring of Honor had a real bad period there for a good chunk of the year. And you could go either way. If not number one, then number two. I probably would have put them in number one, to be honest with you. I mean, and it's not just all the embarrassing stuff that came out at the end of the year, but just the way that the company fell off into the abyss for much of last year. You almost forgot that they even existed. That's all they were doing. They were existing. Not generating any real excitement. Numbers, you know, like attendance was down. Now they've locked up some big names. They seem to be reviving their relationship with New Japan. Their fortunes could be turning around a little bit. But in 2019, it's not a good year for Ring of Honor. And that's a year where they ran their first ever show at Madison Square Garden. And it was not a good year for Ring of Honor. Now back to Utkarsh's question about Chris Jericho. Is Chris Jericho in the top 10 greatest of all time? It is subjective. Everybody has their own list. I gave it some thought. Jericho falls one spot short of my top 10 list when I map out all the names that I feel, for me personally, my personal top 10. Now remember, I grew up just after, you know, that Bruno era. Bruno's not on my list. If you grew up in that era of Bruno Sammartino as the dominant champion and headlining all the big matches at Madison Square Garden, if you grew up in the Northeast, and so guys like Bruno and Superstar Graham, and those are the guys that you grew up with, your list is going to look very different than mine. You're likely to have people like him or Graham or maybe Bob Backlund or somebody possibly in your top 10. It's not in my top 10. This is not ranked. This is my top 10 in no particular order other than maybe generational. Hulk Hogan is number one. Randy Savage, number two. Again, forget the numbers. I'm just listing them out. Hogan, one. Randy Savage, number two. Ric Flair, number three. Bret Hart, number four. Shawn Michaels, number five. Undertaker, number six. As much for the second half of his career than the first half. Number seven, Stone Cold Steve Austin. Number eight, The Rock. Number nine, Kurt Angle. And number 10, Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar makes my top 10. Chris Jericho would be number 11. So for me, he just falls one spot short of that top 10 list. And look, Jericho may yet get there in a few more years. He ain't done yet. Actually, he may end up taking Undertaker's spot. If Undertaker hangs around for much longer and starts to really tarnish his legacy, I may boot him from the list. But Jericho may yet get there in a few more years. He's already accomplished a ton of stuff outside of WWE. In Japan, in AEW. But in WWE alone, you know, the matches that he has had with Chris Benoit, even the skits. You know, I will always remember the bit that he did on SmackDown in 2000. It was in the build-up to SummerSlam, where he mocked up these images of Benoit riding in a boat, Benoit with a goat, Benoit as a blushing bride. He was Dr. Seuss during that promo. It's great. The musical chair segment in 2005, I think maybe it was, or four. I forgot what year it was. Probably four in Winnipeg. Again, one of my all-time favorite segments on Raw. I just thought it was very entertaining, and he was a big part of that. You look at the matches that he had with the Benoits and Shawn Michaels, their feud back in 2008. The very next year, another classic feud. A series of pay-per-view matches against Rey Mysterio. You know, the guest host era. The stuff with him and Bob Barker on that one episode of Raw. It's classic stuff. Probably the best guest host, by the way, they ever had was Bob Barker. Jericho was part of a lot of great moments, a lot of great classic matches. And now he has found success outside of WWE. If he's not top 10 worthy, he's top 15 all time for sure in my book. but I have him at number 11 on my own list. People who aren't old enough to have grown up with, you know, Hogan and Savage in the Mega Powers era, you're less likely to have those two on your list. If you didn't grow up during the early to mid-90s, the New Generation era, you're likely to maybe not have Bret Hart on your list. Or Shawn Michaels, although Shawn Michaels had this whole second half of his career that Bret really didn't have. But you may be less likely to have at least someone like Bret on your list. Kurt Angle, he's a machine. He could do it all. He could be serious. He could do comedy. Kurt is one of the very best ever. Got to be top 10. Brock Lesnar, when he first came in, and now, even pre-UFC, but especially post-UFC, he still brings a legitimate feel to his matches that nobody else does. His matches, to me, even the ones that maybe sometimes do end up being boring, you wish he would do more, it goes 90 seconds, not every match he's in is a winner. But even those matches, when he comes out, gets the big entrance, and he's bouncing up and down in the ring, I mean, it brings a certain feeling to those matches that nobody else on that roster has. He's got something that nobody else has. But all of those guys, to me, they squeeze Jericho just outside my top 10. And you can chime in with your top 10. Yeah, I get questions like this all the time. I don't always like answering them because they're hard, and I get the same ones over and over again. But I was thinking about this, and I was saying, I wonder, does Jericho fall into my top 10? I really had to think about it. And I just mapped out the first 10 names that really felt to me like, these are my top 10. And he fell just outside of that. Him, Cena, they just fell outside the top 10 for me. But chime in and let me know what you think. What does your top 10 look like? I bet it looks different than mine. And that's okay, because it's a subjective thing. There is no one definitive answer about who the top 10 of all time is. It's going to be different no matter who you are, based on your age, and based on when you became a wrestling fan. I don't expect somebody who just started watching wrestling 2 years ago, you know, during the PG era here, to necessarily have Randy Savage on their list, which almost sounds sacrilegious. Randy Savage had a lot of classic matches in WWF with a great story wrapped around them. Steamboat, the whole injury story heading into their match at WrestleMania 3, the Mega Powers angle with Hogan heading into WrestleMania 5, the retirement match with Warrior at WrestleMania 7, the She Was Mine Before She Was Yours story with Liz and Ric Flair heading into WrestleMania 8. The thing I loved about Savage was he didn't just go out and have great matches. There was a story wrapped around them, and they just happened to be some of the best stories in the history of that company. But just for his charisma and his promos alone, he makes the top 10 for me. There's nobody else like him. If you didn't grow up with him, you only know him from the video game. And I feel badly for you people, by the way, who didn't grow up with Randy Savage and don't really know a whole lot about him outside of maybe seeing him in a video game or something. Sucks for you, because he was one of the best to ever do it. So it's all a matter of perspective on these things. Email me your questions. I do read them all, even if I can't include them here on the show. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter @Solomonster. I'll be going live tonight, live tweeting during the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view, and then going live on YouTube after the Elimination Chamber is over later tonight. So join me there for tonight's live stream. We'll recap the entire pay-per-view, probably take some phone calls. We'll have a grand old time on the YouTube channel tonight. And then back here for episode 643, and we get to do it all over again next Sunday. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and I will see you tonight for Elimination Chamber coverage on YouTube. Until next time, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Hello.
Morrison versus Adam Cole, Morrison versus Finn Balor, Morrison versus Tommaso Ciampa, Morrison versus Keith.
Let me ask you a question. Were you drinking during the pay-per-view tonight?
I would.
Okay, I thought so. See, I thought so. Okay.
The Solomonster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/TheSolomonster for sound off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster sounds off.